You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to make a start. If you take your seats, thank you. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Richard Reeves. I'm a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution. It's my great pleasure to welcome all of you to this event. I am the director of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative and co-director of the Center on Children and Families, and we are hosting this event today. I'm just going to tell you what the idea is in terms of the flow. Please use the hashtag #MovingToOpportunity if you're watching on social media. And I'm particularly grateful to those of you in the room, but I don't want to forget the people who are watching online as well. Currently, I think we're about 400 people who are watching this online from around the country and from actually around the world. So thank you to all of you. Please do join in on social media, send your questions, etc., to the panels. The work of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative and of the Center on Children and Families is focused on improving quality of life and promoting upward mobility, especially out of poverty and into a secure middle class family income. And it's with that in mind that we've put this event together today, and also to give some notice to some new research that you're just about to hear about. And so the running order is as follows. We're going to hear two presentations, first from Jens Ludwig, who is a professor of social service administration, law, and public policy, which is a lot to cover, at the University of Chicago, but also a non-resident here at Brookings. And please do check out his latest work, which we've summarized on our website today. And he'll be followed by Nathan Hendren, who is Professor of Economics at Harvard University, and he is one of the founding co-directors, along with Raj Chetty and John Friedman, of Opportunity Insights, which is obviously doing a lot of work in this space and has produced a series of papers that have in some ways motivated some of the work around moving to opportunity. And I am going to take this chance to point out that Nathan was also the recipient of an award relatively recently. It's the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers. So I want to congratulate him on that. Please join me, actually, in giving him a round of applause for that, because until that point, nobody knew that economists counted as scientists or engineers. But we'll definitely let it stand. And then we're going to have two panels, each moderated by a colleague of mine from Brookings, who I'll introduce when that time comes. The questions that are going to underpin the conversations we have today, as far as I see it, are along the following lines. Does place itself matter for opportunity? In a causal fashion, does where you live matter for your outcomes? Can moving places lead to greater opportunity? If it can, when and how does it, in fact, lead to greater opportunities following a move? How can we make more moves to greater opportunity by identifying the barriers, lowering them, and incentivizing people to move? And last but not least, should you have to move to have opportunity? Or put slightly differently, what do we do to ensure that the places from which people move are also places of high opportunity? So those are some of the framing questions I hope we're going to get to today in our presentations and in the panels. And also just a note on terminology, we're going to be talking today about moving to opportunity, capital M, capital O, the specific program, which we're going to be hearing a lot about, and moving to opportunity, a small m, small o, which is the general sense that people can move to an area of higher opportunity. And so I just invite the speakers, just if you are using it in one of those particular ways, to try and help us through it, because moving to opportunity and moving to opportunity are not always used in the same way when you're discussing it with academics who work on moving to opportunity. So with that, I'll hand over to our first speaker. Oh, I should say also the speakers will just take 5 minutes of questions at the end of their presentations. Those are largely for clarification purposes about the papers they presented. I think the substantive issues will be better left to the panels and the experts that will be on those panels, including our speakers and their co-authors. So with that, I'll hand over to our first speaker, Jens. Thank you. Please join me in welcoming Jens.
Great. Thanks so much. The hypothesis that place itself might matter for economic advantage or disadvantage in the United States stems in part from the fact that you see such strong patterning of people's life outcomes in neighborhoods that are incredibly geographically proximate to one another. So You see this maybe most vividly in places like the south side of Chicago, where I live. So starting in the 1940s, the city of Chicago developed some housing projects on the State Street corridor that runs from the downtown. This is just west of the Washington Park neighborhood on the south side. And if you literally just cross the street, in this case, Cottage Grove Avenue, that separates the Washington Park neighborhood from the Hyde Park neighborhood, where the University of Chicago is located, you can see dramatic differences in things like the likelihood that kids graduate from high school, the overall crime rate, health outcomes, infant mortality, and on and on and on. So this was a pattern that University of Chicago sociologists noticed at least 100 years ago and raised the question of what might there be about neighborhood environments that could causally influence people's life outcomes, things like differential access to neighborhood institutions or middle-class families that might serve as role models or sources of job referrals. There's a different hypothesis, though, which is that maybe the patterning that we see across these neighborhoods might instead reflect some differences in the types of families that wind up living in different types of neighborhoods. And so to answer that question, in 1992, the Congress authorized a HUD demonstration called Moving to Opportunity that set eligibility for families with kids living in some of the most economically distressed housing projects in the country in five cities, Baltimore, Boston, Chicago, LA, and New York, enrolled a total of 4,600 families over a four-year period from 1994 to 1998. So to give you some sense for what the baseline neighborhoods look like in Chicago, my hometown, the Robert Taylor Homes, were one of the baseline sites. You can see some pictures from when these were still standing. So families voluntarily signed up for Moving to Opportunity, and then they were randomly assigned by HUD to one of three different groups. So one possibility is that families could be assigned to a control group that doesn't get any additional assistance to move out of these baseline housing projects, but weren't constrained from moving out on their own. The second possibility is that families could be randomly assigned into what we call a low poverty voucher group that received a Section 8 housing voucher subsidy to lease an apartment in the private housing market, but with the restriction that they had to move to a neighborhood, a census tract, with a 1990 poverty rate below 10%. It's a way to think about the size of that move. The baseline poverty rate for the neighborhood, the MTO neighborhoods, were on the order of 40 to 50+%, depending on what specific city you're looking at. And they also received some additional mobility counseling beyond what's normally provided to Section 8 housing recipients. And then the third possibility is families could be randomly assigned to receive a regular Section 8 housing voucher. So this gives you some visual sense for the types of neighborhoods that families moved into. If you look at a map of the different MTO cities, you can see it's almost like has a flower patterning with families in the control group in the middle in the baseline housing projects, with usually the families receiving the regular housing vouchers sort of ringed around them, and then the families receiving the low poverty vouchers in an outer ring beyond them as well. Here's what it looks like if you look at neighborhood poverty rates. So this is on the x-axis for the control group and the low poverty voucher group. And on the y-axis is the share of families in the different groups. And you can see that there are indeed, so the red distribution here are the families in the control group. And you can see that there are indeed some control group families who wind up moving into lower poverty neighborhoods on their own. So there's some overlap in the neighborhood poverty distributions, but you can also see that most of the families in the control group are living in neighborhoods with poverty rates, you know, over the 10 to 15 year follow-up period that are somewhere between, say, 25 and 50%. And in contrast, you can see the yellow graph here is the distribution of neighborhood poverty for the families assigned into the low poverty voucher group who moved. And you can see that there's a noticeable increase in the share of those families living in much, much lower poverty neighborhoods, 10 or 20% averaged over the entire study period. If you look at the families who received the regular housing vouchers versus the control group, you can see that there's a mean shift in neighborhood poverty rates over the study period, but it's not nearly as pronounced. So the low poverty voucher intervention was successful in generating much larger differences in neighborhood economic conditions, although more modest changes in neighborhood racial segregation, which I think will be a point that will come up probably a bunch in the research panel, in the first research panel. So what happens to families when they receive a housing subsidy like this and move from very, very economically disadvantaged housing developments into lower poverty neighborhoods? Well, let me start with a story for MTO adults. If you look at the 1992 congressional legislation authorizing MTO, the key outcomes that it focuses on are schooling outcomes for kids and economic outcomes for adults. When we look at the adults in MTO, when we follow up their outcomes 10 to 15 years after baseline, what we see is indeed very large impacts on adults, but not where we expect it. So we see very large changes in things like mental health and physical health. So if you look at, for instance, the prevalence of adults who meet clinical criteria for depression, you see very sizable differences between families who received low poverty vouchers and the control group. And if you look at health outcomes like morbid obesity, or even diabetes, you see very substantial differences, again, between low poverty voucher families and the control group. More muted differences for the families who receive regular vouchers, consistent with the fact that the families who receive regular vouchers also experience more muted changes in neighborhood conditions. When you turn to economic outcomes for adults, the thing that the initial MTO authorizing legislation was focused on the adult side, you see no detectable differences in employment rates or earnings or any other outcomes. So this is a graph over time by number of quarters since the time of random assignment for employment rates for the three different groups in MTO, and you can see that they track each other very closely over the entire period. There's a little bit of cyclicality with the business cycle for all families, but no differences across groups. So this raises, for starters, something of a puzzle because, as I said, social scientists and medical researchers and anybody who studies human behavior and human outcomes has been interested in the role of place in neighborhoods and people's life outcomes for decades or centuries. I think the first study of neighborhood effects that I know of was first published in the 1700s in London. And there are countless dozens and dozens of studies claiming that neighborhoods exert very important impacts on outcomes, including adult economic outcomes. And so how do we reconcile this puzzle of moving to opportunity, showing no gains in adult earnings versus so many previous non-experimental studies showing big impacts? So that's been the topic of some work that Jeff Kling and I and some other people have been doing with David Harding at the Berkeley Sociology Department for the last few years to try and reconcile the apparent differences between moving to opportunity and the observational neighborhood effects research. And some of the hypotheses that people in the initial years when the MTO research was coming out, some of the hypotheses that people had offered included things like, well, the MTO families are unusually disadvantaged, drawn from unusually disadvantaged neighborhoods. Only about a quarter-ish of the eligible families in those baseline housing developments signed up for MTO. Maybe there's just something intrinsically different about those families that makes them less responsive to changes in community environments. A different type of hypothesis that's been offered for trying to reconcile MTO with other neighborhood effect studies is maybe the treatment dose of the neighborhood changes induced by MTO are not pronounced enough to change economic outcomes for adults. So maybe families didn't spend a long enough time in really low poverty neighborhoods, or maybe there wasn't a large enough change in neighborhood racial composition to change adult outcomes. And we've spent some time reanalyzing the MTO data and comparing those results to data from the panel study of income dynamics, and we think that we can rule out these sorts of explanations for why MTO is different from previous studies on adult earnings. The most likely explanation, based on our analysis of the different data sets, suggests that What's going on here is in the previous neighborhood effect studies, the types of families who wind up in lower poverty neighborhoods include adults who would have had better economic outcomes anyway. And so the previous, at least with respect to adult economic outcomes, previous neighborhood effect studies seem to have been confounding the influence of neighborhood environments with the influence of something else about the household characteristics themselves. So that's the story for adults. If we turn to MTO children, again, following the kids out through 10 to 15 years after baseline, we saw remarkably limited impacts on kids, at least 10 to 15 years out after baseline. We saw some improvements in health and behavioral outcomes, particularly for girls, but almost no signs of improved academic outcomes, the thing that the congressional legislation that authorized MTO was focused on, for either boys or girls, regardless of the age that kids were at baseline. So the story up through 10 to 15 years was quite disappointing, I think, from the perspective of neighborhood moves trying to improve the long-term life chances of children. And then, due to some incredible ingenuity from Nathan Hendren, who's here, and Raj Chetty and Larry Katz, they managed to track outcomes for people in MTO for an even longer time period than we were originally able to do by linking information on MTO program participants to IRS tax data. So when we followed people out through 10 to 15 years, you know, if you think about kids who are very young at baseline, they're not quite old enough yet to have really fully integrated into the labor market. And so when we're looking at things like earnings outcomes, it's not super meaningful when people are late adolescence or early adulthood. And so what they were able to do with the IRS tax data is essentially discover a pattern that looks like this. So let me just talk you through what this is. So on the y-axis here is the difference in earnings during adulthood between people assigned to the low poverty voucher group versus the control group. And what you're seeing along the x-axis here is the age at which income is measured for the MTO program participant. And what you're seeing in the red line here is what that looks like for the MTO kids who are age 13 or older at baseline. And essentially what you see is little difference between the low poverty voucher group and the control group in earnings for the MTO kids who are already adolescents at baseline. And if anything, maybe some hint of some decline in earnings. In contrast, if you look at the blue line here, this is the low poverty voucher versus control difference in earnings for the kids who are under age 13 at baseline. And you can see that as you follow kids out into their mid to late 20s, you can start to see very pronounced differences in earnings as a result of the MTO-induced moves. And so this is an example of, I think, partly the heightened, potentially the heightened sensitivity of children early in life, as a lot of research starting with neurons to neighborhoods had suggested. And I think also from a social science and policy analysis perspective, the enormous value of this research infrastructure that comes from the IRS tax database that Raj and Nathan have been able to assemble. So what does this all mean for public policy? Well, for starters, to recap the findings, there do seem to be some long-term benefits to kids, especially kids who are very young at baseline. And the story from MTO and neighborhood mobility for adults, I think, depends a lot on what you care about. If you're focused very narrowly on reducing income poverty, you will think about MTO and neighborhood moves as something of a disappointment, at least for people who are already adults. If your objective instead is to improve the well-being of poor people, MTO yields a much more optimistic story for adults, given these improvements and things that are very important for life outcomes. What does this imply for public policy? I think this will be obviously a topic of a lot of discussion in the follow-up panels, but Rob Collison, who's a new assistant professor at Notre Dame, and I have a Brookings policy brief that just came out today that starts to sketch out some of the different policy implications of the entire body of MTO research. And I think one strand of policy thinking that I think we want to engage in now is how exactly do we make our existing housing programs more helpful for low-income families? And given the pattern of benefits that we see in MTO, I think a very natural place to start is to think about ways of prioritizing housing subsidies for families with young children, if part of the goal is long-term poverty reduction and promotion of social mobility. I think there are a variety of things that we can think about doing to make housing vouchers better able to help families move into lower poverty neighborhoods. Things like making them the voucher program work better from the perspective of the landlords, changing the way that the voucher subsidies work across neighborhoods with different poverty rates. These are things that will come up during the policy panel, I'm sure. A different type of, I think, policy question raised by this pattern of MTO findings is thinking about what other types of supports we need to improve the economic outcomes for adults. And so I think what MTO says is that mobility alone is not enough to do that. What types of supplements do we need to boost adults' labor market outcomes? And the final thing that I will end on is the point that Richard mentioned at the end of his introduction, which is there's no state of the world in which we are. So right now, I think, as probably most people in the room know, housing subsidies are sufficiently generous, and the overall housing subsidy budget in the United States is sufficiently limited, where only something like a quarter of all income-eligible households in the United States receive a federal housing subsidy. So for starters, we're not even providing any sort of housing subsidy, whether that's public housing or other place-based housing subsidy, much less a housing voucher. We're not getting much good coverage over low-income housing families for starters. There's no conceivable way in which we'll ever be able to provide every low-income family with a chance to participate in a mobility program. And so I think to the extent to which this new longer-term MTO research has rejuvenated attention to place-based policies, I think that raises a lot of questions about what else we can do to change the neighborhood environments themselves in which poor families are currently living. And the thing that I wanted to close with was something of a surprise, I think, to many of us who started off in the MTO research. You know, when many of us were thinking about why families would sign up for MTO initially, people who spent a lot of time thinking about education were sure that MTO families would sign up for access to better schools. If you were a health person, you're sure it would be access to better health care. If you were a labor economist, you were sure that it was going to be due to access to better job opportunities. But when Jeff Kling and Jeff Liebman and Larry Katz went out and started to talk to MTO families in Boston about a million years ago, one of the things that they realized was most important from the perspective of the families themselves, and we can actually see this in the survey data as well, is neighborhood safety. And I think that's not surprising if you've been reading some of the research that people like Pat Sharkey have been doing over time, showing the effects of exposure to community violence on children's schooling outcomes, on mental health, on overall well-being. And so, you know, there's a lot of policy energy around thinking about community economic development, improving schools, and all of these things are clearly important. And I think just one lesson about place-based policy that I hope doesn't also get lost in the conversation is that we all prioritize, don't lose sense, sight of the neighborhood feature that the MTO families themselves prioritize as well, which is safety. Thank you very much. And then I think we have a few minutes for clarifying questions.
But you were pretty clear.
But I was...
We may not need it. In which case, we should pause, but we should use the time for the panel.
Okay, perfect. Okay, thank you.
So thanks. Everybody hear me okay? Great.
Just a little bit.
There we go. All right. So it's a pleasure to be here. Just want to say thanks for the opportunity to speak with you all. I'm looking forward to telling you a little bit about some of the work on the Creating Moves to Opportunity project, and looking forward to hearing all of your questions and thoughts as well. So I'm going to talk about Creating Moves to Opportunity, experimental evidence on neighborhood choice among voucher recipients. Just at the outset, I want to be clear, this is a joint work with Peter Bergman, Raj Chetty, Stephanie DeLuca here in the audience, Larry Katz, and Chris Palmer, and also has been an enormous collaboration with the Seattle and King County housing authorities, Sarah Oppenheimer here in the second row, who you'll hear from later, MDRC, and J. Paul North America. And we want to motivate what we were after with this work with really four facts on neighborhoods and economic opportunity. The first fact is that children's prospects for upward income mobility vary substantially across neighborhoods in the United States, and even nearby neighborhoods. So I'm going to start at a broad level of looking at the extent to which kids climb the economic ladder based on where they grew up. So what you're looking at here is the average incomes of kids at age 35 for children who grew up in low-income families, so families who earn about, say, $27,000 a year, and how that maps out based on which metropolitan or rural area they grew up in the United States. And so you can see enormous variation in the extent to which kids climb the ladder. So in Atlanta, children earn about $27,000 a year. Here in D.C., it's about $34,000, $37,000 in Boston. You can go to parts of the Midwest where you're in excess of $45,000 a year. And so there's enormous differences in the extent to which kids are climbing the ladder. Now, as we zoom in into finer geographies, what I think was most surprising to us is that this broad variation actually replicates within virtually every major metropolitan area in the United States. So this is showing you that the upward income mobility of different census tracts in the Seattle and King County area. And you can see just within Seattle, you have the same level of variation you saw on the national map. So the color scheme is basically the same. You see incomes in some neighborhoods around $25,000 to $30,000 a year. You go out to Eastgate or North Queen Anne, portions of Bellevue where you see $40,000 to $50,000 a year. For children who are growing up in families whose parents earn the same amount of money but just happen to be growing up in different neighborhoods. The second fact that we want to motivate this work with is that moving to better neighborhoods improves children's economic outcomes in adulthood significantly and in proportion to the exposure time that they have in those areas while they're growing up. And so I just want to show some evidence on this. So Jens alluded to this in the MTO example, which is in the center graph on the bottom there. And what you see in the MTO example is that children who were below age 13, the youngest children in the Moving to Opportunity experiment, had the largest gains from their families obtaining these vouchers and given the opportunity to move to higher opportunity areas, or in this case, lower poverty areas. What you're looking at in the other graphs are other quasi-experimental pieces of evidence that build on a body of work that I think motivated a lot of the way in which one can rationalize the MTO findings through this exposure time idea. And so the upper the graph on the upper left is showing you that families with children who move at younger ages, those children grow up to have higher outcomes if they grow up in neighborhoods that have higher rates of upward mobility. Conversely, the longer a child spends growing up in a neighborhood that has lower rates of upward mobility, the lower their outcomes would be in adulthood. Now, that pattern has been replicated not only in the United States, but also in Australia, in Montreal, in Danish data, and also if you find a similar exposure time pattern looking at Hope 6 demolition. So this is some work by Eric Chin documenting that the youngest children whose families were displaced from Hope 6 during the Hope 6 process from public housing projects were the ones who experienced the largest economic gains in adulthood. And so broadly what this suggests is that neighborhoods matter. We are, in a sense, a product of where we grew up, and that product is a function of how long we spent growing up in those in each of those places. So turning now to the policy perspective on this, the third fact is that low-income families, and in particular low-income families who receive housing vouchers, predominantly live in low-opportunity areas. And so this, again, you see in virtually every major metropolitan area, but I'm going to motivate this with the picture from Seattle. So this is the 25 most common census tracts for where housing choice voucher recipients live in the Seattle area. And if you take a look at the graph here, you can see that these green dots tend to concentrate in areas that have lower rates of upward mobility. And this is a pattern that you see virtually in every city and metropolitan area of the United States. Now, one potential rationalization for why families, and particular low-income families, are growing up or raising their children in neighborhoods that have lower rates of upward mobility. One potential explanation for that is that the neighborhoods that have higher rates of upward mobility might just simply be more expensive. And we do see that, in general, neighborhoods that have higher rates of upward mobility have higher rents on average. So this is showing you that pattern in Seattle. On the horizontal axis, you're looking at the median two-bedroom rent in 2015 from the census. And on the vertical axis, you're seeing the average income of kids who grew up in low-income families in each of those different census tracts in Seattle. And the pattern is increasing. But I think what's notable about this pattern is that there is a lot of variation. There's a lot of sort of variation around that axis. So in particular, if you compare a couple places like the Central District or North Queen Anne, and you look in the census data, it doesn't look like the rents are all that that different. And it at least raises the question that there's perhaps potential for moving to some of these higher opportunity areas without actually experiencing higher rent. Now, of course, there could be a range of alternative trade-offs that families would face when moving to some of these other neighborhoods. And so more broadly, I think this turns to the question, the central question that we want to use as motivation for the experiment I'm going to talk with you about today. And that question is, why don't low-income families move to opportunity? Right? It's the basic question that we really want to address. It seems like neighborhoods matter. It seems like if you did move to a neighborhood that has higher rates of upward mobility, your children would have higher earnings. And so what's going on here? Well, broadly, we think there can be two classes of explanations. On the one hand, we could imagine that this is a preference story, that perhaps families prefer to stay in maybe their current neighborhoods. Maybe those neighborhoods have other amenities. Maybe they have shorter commutes. Maybe they have greater proximity to family. Now, on the other hand, perhaps families, and low-income families in particular, face greater barriers when thinking of moving to higher opportunity areas. Perhaps they have trouble because of lack of information of how to find a unit in a high opportunity area, or they face other search frictions, or perhaps they face discrimination from landlords that don't particularly want them to lease their units in the high opportunity areas. And we think this distinction is really critical from a policy standpoint, because then if barriers are really what is driving this story, it raises the policy question of, can we relax those barriers through public policy? And in particular, you know, if barriers are driving segregation, can we do this through changes in affordable housing policy like the Housing Choice Voucher Program? And so this motivated the Creating Moves to Opportunity experiment in the Seattle and King County area. This is a randomized controlled trial with the aim to develop and test policy scalable strategies to reduce the barriers that housing choice voucher recipients face in moving to high opportunity areas. And so to do this experiment, we wanted to start by defining opportunity areas. So we showed you this map that, you know, it's sort of got all these different colors on it, but we wanted to imagine an intervention that would provide families with the resources and perhaps supports that could help relax the barriers that they might face when moving to opportunity areas or neighborhoods with higher opportunity. And so we started by defining what we mean by high opportunity areas. Now, our target population is going to be families with children. And so we decided to define opportunity areas by places that had the greatest chance of improving their children's outcomes or raising their children's incomes in adulthood. And so we used the Opportunity Atlas, which is what I was showing you screenshots of that several slides ago, to define opportunity areas as places where historically children from low-income families have had the highest incomes. That's basically how we went about defining opportunity areas for this experiment. And then we started roughly with the top third of the distribution of opportunity areas, neighborhoods in Seattle and King County to define our opportunity areas. And then we adjusted those definitions, collaborating with folks in the housing authorities, to think about two potential issues for actually implementing this design. The first is to think about neighborhood change. So when we were showing you those graphs, those are the average incomes of kids who are age 35 today, which means they were growing up in those neighborhoods many years ago. And so we might want to worry about to what extent are neighborhoods changing over time. So we got data on test scores, other things that you can measure at younger ages to try to assess the extent to which neighborhoods and their upward mobility characteristics are changing over time. Now, one of the things I'll just say briefly on this that we were pretty surprised by, and I think surprises everybody that we talk with on this, is that we actually found, while you can see lots of differences in the composition of residents in these different areas over time, you know, some places get richer, some places get poorer, when you really zoom in and try to find evidence that there's changes in the upward mobility characteristics of neighborhoods, we really didn't find any significant changes. And so, for example, in many of the areas that we were looking at, when you look at, say, the test scores of third-grade test scores of children on the free and reduced-price lunch programs, it actually looks like even in gentrifying neighborhoods, quote-unquote, those things are fairly flatlined. And so at the end of the day, we ended up not doing much in terms of adjusting for neighborhood change, but I think this is always going to be an important thing to keep in mind with these types of exercises. The second is just naturally there's some cases where you're missing a track that didn't fall into the top third and you want to create a contiguous area. And so that was the second thing from an operations standpoint of thinking about an implementation. We wanted to do something that was going to be clear to the families. And so this is the neighborhoods, a picture of the neighborhoods that we settled on for defining opportunity neighborhoods. So these are hashed out in blue here. They show you all the opportunity areas that we defined in the Seattle and King County area. Okay, so those are the opportunity areas. What do we do from the treatment? Now, if you recall, we want to try to understand to what extent are barriers the reason that families are not moving to these different areas. And so we designed a treatment that has three different components. The first is customized search assistance, so helping families find units in these areas. So we partnered families with an individual from a nonprofit that helped families search in these different areas and helped them think through their search process. We also, member of the nonprofit also reached out directly to landlords in high opportunity areas to try to bring them into the Housing Choice Voucher program and provide units for these families. And we also provided them with short-term financial assistance, so helping things with like application fees and things of that nature. And so just to put some numbers on what this sort of looked like, on average, the staff was spending about 6 hours with these families in their search process. So this is a decently intensive collaboration that this staff had with each of these families in the study. And it also appears that the landlord component was pretty central for a lot of these families. So half of the families who end up making moves to opportunity areas that I'll show you, half of those connections were established through units identified by these rental brokers, the nonprofit staff that families were working with. And then on average, the financial assistance summed up to about $1,000 to cover things like increased security deposits or application fees in some of these neighborhoods. And so overall, the program costs about $2,600. So that's actually a decently sized program when you think about it. This is a fairly intensive intervention for these families. When you step back, though, and view this from the perspective of how much money are we spending on the families from the voucher perspective, so sum up the HAP, the total amount that the cost of the voucher over the average of 7 years that these families are experiencing that voucher, it's only about 2% of the total amount of money that these families are getting. And so really, how much you think about whether this program is expensive or cheap really depends on your perspective. From the perspective of the total amount of money these families are getting, it's quite cheap. Last thing I want to say. Goal is to distinguish between preferences and constraints. So as a result, in contrast to the MTO experiment, where families had to move to a low poverty census tract in order to be able to use that voucher, we are not going to restrict the vouchers to be used in low poverty or high opportunity areas. We're going to allow families to use those vouchers wherever they would like, but we're going to pair them with services to help them access some of the higher opportunity areas. And so that's, I think, an important distinction that we wanted to test with this experiment relative to the MTO work. Okay, so what were the results? So I'm going to show you a graph here where on the vertical axis is just simply the fraction of families that move to a high opportunity area, so one of those shaded regions in the map that I showed you. And just to put some historical perspective on this, historically, families with vouchers, about 11 or 12% of them would move to these areas. So that's about the rough fraction of vouchers that are used to, in those higher opportunity areas. Now, for the control group, we found fairly similar rates of about 14% being used in high opportunity areas. And for the treatment group, when they got these services, we found that over half of them decided to move to these higher opportunity areas. And so we found an enormous difference in the extent to which families would move. You know, making one of these fairly large decisions for your life, where do you choose to raise your children, seems to have really moved the needle on that decision through this intervention. Now, one potential story you could have in mind is that perhaps we just increased the total fraction of families that actually were able to find a house or able to find a unit with their voucher, because these services helped families actually find units. You're paired with the member of the nonprofit staff. Turns out that's actually not what this program did. So even 84-85% of families in the control group were able to use their voucher. They just chose to use it in a place that did, in a non-high opportunity neighborhood. And so this difference between the control and the treatment group and the fraction of families that exercised the voucher was not statistically significant. And so really what the program did was change not whether families used the voucher, but where they chose to use it. And so let me put a little bit of picture on that. This is a kind of a graph or a map showing you where families in the treatment and the control group used the vouchers. So the green is the treatment group, the red is the control group. And I think the thing that to really point out here is that the families in green are largely pretty scattered throughout the opportunity areas. There's some clustering, you know, a couple of like pairs in particular units, but broadly scattered throughout the various ranges of high opportunity areas. It doesn't seem like it's generating significant clustering in any one particular area. We also see very strong effects across different races and ethnicities. So one hypothesis, if you thought that, say, preferences were heterogeneous and perhaps more tied to particular neighborhoods for particular races or ethnicities, you might have seen smaller effects for some races and ethnicities relative to others. We don't see any statistically distinguishable differences across these different groups. There's a slightly smaller point effect for Black non-Hispanic participants, but that's not statistically distinguishable from the other patterns. And broadly, in any of the subgroups that we were able to slice, we really don't see any significant patterns of heterogeneity. Really, across the spectrum, we found fairly large effects on the order of about 40 percentage points for any of the subgroups that we were really able to tease out. Another question you might ask is, are families making other trade-offs when they move to higher opportunity areas? A couple things we can take a look at there. How far do they go relative to where they start? That actually doesn't seem to vary between the treatment and the control group. Relative to where they're starting, they're moving roughly the same distance, and they also don't seem to be living in units that are any larger or any smaller. And I think this comes back to the story of potentially the existence of a lot of dispersion within the set of opportunity areas in terms of prices. Now, lastly, one kind of fundamental question, and especially as it relates to the extent to which we'll generate exposure effects on these kids, is the extent to which families would persist in these opportunity areas. And one story that you might have is that perhaps families that were paired with these this nonprofit staff went to the high opportunity areas, but they did it through a little bit, perhaps even you might even call it like a coercion from the, you know, you paired up with somebody who's really here to help you and they're saying, hey, you should move here. And so you're going to go there and now you may not stay. And so Stephanie DeLuca and many other, and her team has been conducting follow-up interviews with the families now that they've been there for a while to say, okay, you know, are you satisfied in your destination neighborhood? Do you want to stay in your destination neighborhood? And the broad story here is that if anything, the pattern goes the other way. These families are more satisfied with their neighborhoods. They seem to be wanting to stay in those neighborhoods and don't seem to be trading off something along the way. Okay, so in conclusion here, broad conclusion is that we think segregation is largely driven by barriers and constraints, not by any kind of preference. And so, moreover, services that reduce barriers can increase moves to opportunity and increase upward mobility, we think, substantially for kids. So just to kind of put some numbers on this, as I said before, the program costs $2,600 per voucher issued. If you scale that by the fraction of children that move to opportunity neighborhoods, that's $4,700 per opportunity move. The experiment itself, we think, based on the Opportunity Atlas, that prediction of what we know from what neighborhoods do to kids' incomes, we think that if you took a child at birth and imagine they grew up in one of the neighborhoods that the families moved to, they would have incomes that are $200,000 higher, roughly 10% higher, and would also increase their college attendance rates, reduce teen birth rates, and reduce incarceration rates. And so for a kind of a bang for the buck perspective, this program seems to have a pretty high return. Now, coming back to what Richard was discussing at the beginning and what Jens is referring to, I don't think this is any reason to run away from other forms of place-based policy and investing in places. I think, if anything, what we're learning here is that families want the best for their kids. And so that means that we should also think about improving the neighborhoods where those families currently reside. And I think there's a high value of further work along the lines of the types of RCTs that we've been seeing along these that we've been discussing with the Moving to Opportunity experiment that can hopefully shed more light on those types of policies. But I do think this work suggests that expanding high opportunity access to high opportunity neighborhoods provides an immediate tool for both decreasing segregation and expanding economic opportunity for kids. So I'll leave it at that and turn it over to questions.
Did you give any consideration to communities that had inclusionary zoning or scattered site policies and programs?
Can you repeat that for everybody?
Yeah. Was any consideration given, and I recognize that we're looking right now at this particular case study, but those communities that already have inclusionary zoning programs as well as scattered site units?
Yeah, so I guess I would be curious what you would mean by consideration. I mean, so the work that we were doing was not interacting in any particular focused way with other baseline policy characteristics of any of the local areas, but yeah. Yeah.
The question is, were those opportunity communities lacking any other kinds of programs that would, in fact, encourage integration as well as a higher academic standard?
Gotcha. So I think this broadly relates to the question of, are the opportunity neighborhoods that we identify places that would actually improve the incomes of the kids who are moving there? And so we did a lot of work to try to understand the extent to which that. So there's a lot of reasons that children perhaps may not be well integrated into these particular neighborhoods. I think one of the examples or some, we had some examples of neighborhoods that, let me walk you through a couple examples. So I think broadly our conclusion is that the Opportunity Atlas provides a pretty good guide for neighborhoods that have a high causal effect on kids' outcomes. We think other particular characteristics, like the poverty rate, for example, is subject to more concerns along the lines of other types of confounding factors when trying to think about what is the impact that a neighborhood has on kids' outcomes. And so one particular example I can give you on that front is that I think we were studying one of the neighborhoods that had gentrified in near downtown Seattle, that had experienced pretty significant reductions in poverty and expansions in mean incomes. But it actually looked to us, according to the Opportunity Atlas, like it had low rates of upward mobility. And this is the case where we went back and got some of the test score information. And what you see is increases in test scores for children in those areas, if you just look at mean test scores. But then when you restrict to children on free and reduced price lunch, it was actually much more of a flat line in those neighborhoods, which I think speaks exactly to this type of inclusion question of when neighborhoods are gentrifying, is it actually uplifting all residents in those areas? And I think in a couple of the instances we were trying to take a look at, we did not necessarily see significant patterns that were related to that. Now, I don't want anybody to take away from that sort of saying, you know, gentrification is good or bad. That's not what this paper was really focused on. But we did try to do some work on this question to really understand whether the Opportunity Atlas was providing a relevant guide for these families. Other questions? Yeah.
In the Seattle area regarding early learning centers. And so I know a huge issue is racial segregation within early learning centers due to difficulty braiding funding between state and federal early learning programs. So I was wondering what you factored into your analysis involving that issue.
Yeah. So we didn't, but I'm going to punt on that one and let that come to the group when we're up here. We didn't focus on much of that in terms of the this research question, but I think it'll be a good question for the group. Yeah. Go to the back maybe, and then I'll come around.
This is great stuff. Thank you. I wondered to if you could sort of think about the voucher holders themselves as being a subset of because I think it's a little bit confusing about it, conclusions about low-income people or poor people in general, and voucher people's have voucher holders have a specific profile, specific route to getting a voucher, and how that may, if you could sort of distinguish them from the other population of low-income people in the same neighborhoods.
Yeah, one of the things we were surprised by in a lot of the moving work is that, for example, when you compare the quasi-experimental evidence that I was showing you on the graphs or the impact that neighborhoods have on kids, you can look broadly at all moves across the U.S. for families with children and compare that to the experiences you see for MTO families. And broadly, you see fairly similar patterns, which I think speaks a little bit to this kind of question of are children of voucher holders different or are voucher holders different? I think the from the perspective of what's going to happen to their children, I think the answer is no. I think to Jens's point, the types of families that are selecting into the program and moving to higher opportunity areas we think are selected and make it difficult to do a lot of work that just simply compares the groups who move to opportunity versus don't.
Okay, I'm going to ask people to hold just because we want to keep on time. The good news is Nathan's staying on the panel. So I'm not saying don't ask your question. I'm just saying hold for a second. I'm going to invite the panel to come on, but please join me again in thanking Nathan for his presentation.
Thank you.
And if our first panel go up. The structure of the panels, I should have said this at the beginning, what we're hoping is the first panel will be able to dig even further into what do we know, the research questions, and that the second panel will be able to focus somewhat more on how do we use what we know, a bit more of the how, the practicalities of how we turn that knowledge to good effect. The first panel is going to be moderated by my colleague Jenny Schutz. She's the David M. Rubenstein Fellow in our Metropolitan Policy Program here at Brookings, and she's also a member of the scholarly team working on future of the middle class issues. So with that, I'll hand over to Jenny.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks to all of you for sitting patiently through the presentations and thinking of all of the great questions that you want to ask at the end of our panel. So I'll ask you to keep those in mind. I'd like to give brief introductions to our panelists. So Nathan, you've already met. Nathan's a professor of economics at Harvard and co-director of the Equality of Opportunity Project. You have a sense of what his research is on because you just saw some of it. Next to Nathan is Jeff Kling. Jeff is the Associate Director for Economic Analysis at the Congressional Budget Office. He's written extensively on public housing and high poverty neighborhoods. On the other side of Jeff is Pat Sharkey. Pat's a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He studies crime and urban neighborhoods. And on the far end is Stephanie DeLuca. Stephanie is the James Coleman Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at Johns Hopkins University, just up the road from us in Baltimore. Her research focuses on how social context affects the outcomes of disadvantaged young people, and she is one of Nathan's co-authors on the paper that was just presented. Thank you guys for being here today. All right, so I think we're going to dive in first to the CMTO project. So I'm going to talk about CMTO as being the Seattle work, and I'll talk about MTO as being the more general project that Jeff and Jens had worked on. So the CMTO project is a really nice way of starting to understand some of the barriers that low-income families face in moving to higher opportunity neighborhoods, low-poverty neighborhoods. We'll come back to that in a moment. But I wanted to ask Stephanie in particular, because you've done some qualitative interviews with the families who moved. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the families were telling you about their perception of the barriers? So if you learned anything about why they hadn't moved to high opportunity neighborhoods before or what they saw as the hurdles to moving to these places.
Turns green. Okay, great.
Yeah, do all of you hold it right up here.
Okay. All right. Good afternoon. So thanks for the question, Jenny, because I think one of the things that's exciting, being up here and sharing this with you is a chance to take the stories of the nearly 120 families that we've talked to in Seattle and bring them here from their homes and McDonald's and Starbucks and libraries and be able to share them widely. And so I'm grateful for them to, for having shared time with us as we were able to better understand this intervention from their perspective. So I think there are a lot of different ways to come at this. The first thing that I'll say that I think is important and has driven a lot of the mixed methods work I've done on experiments and quasi-experimental interventions is to remember that even if families move, a lot of the challenges that they face also move with them. What that means is they've just, had years of experiences, traumatic, challenging experiences, that really shape the way that they make decisions. And so I think, the question of why, they hadn't made decisions to move to higher opportunity neighborhoods is, maybe better thought of as, how, they've spent so much time trying to juggle whatever they can while they have it, right? I mean, we think about this as sort of a bandwidth tax. And so I think what I heard when we sat down to talk to families, when we say, first, tell us the story of your life. And that's how we start. And that could take 30 minutes or it could take 2 hours. And then we get to the other stuff. But I think, the first thing is, we met families who, nearly a third of the caregivers we spoke to had been victims of domestic violence. Nearly a third had had significant health problems on themselves or, among their children. A quarter were homeless in some way, broadly defined, in the 6 months before we met them. These all really shape the kinds of decisions that get made every day. We talked to families from 14 different countries, which was striking. I'm used to living, studying places like Baltimore and Cleveland and Dallas, where there are a lot of families who have always been there. And Washington State is a place that invites families from lots of other places. And so one challenge, I think, too, was just families trying to understand how to navigate institutions and policies locally. This was especially true for the immigrant families, that especially those from East African countries. But I think, in terms of the biggest barriers when we talk to them about their residential history more generally, the biggest barrier we heard about was credit. And it's hard to, I think, overstate the importance of credit and the effect it has on how families perceive themselves as potential clients and tenants that would go to a landlord and say, I'd like to rent one of your places. We can talk more broadly when we talk about maybe aspects of the intervention that really helped ease the process for families to lease up who had credit history. But I think the process of being repeatedly denied units because of a spotty credit history is really demoralizing, casting somewhat of a residential pessimism, I would call it, on the way families view their choices and their decisions. One mom in Seattle said to me, Sandra said, they won't let you rent when you have credit problems, but you can have a criminal background in Seattle. I don't have any crimes, but I still can't find a place. And so I think the credit problems were really big. The navigators did a lot of work to help smooth that process out, but that was still one thing, I think, and that, stems from a host of other barriers, right, besides housing, I think, that we could certainly talk about.
So this point that Stephanie makes, just it strikes me as a good point to note how important it is to have ethnographers do this research. When you try to digest everything that's come out from Moving to Opportunity with capital M, it's impossible. And the reason is because this kind of intervention into a family's life produces extremely complex results, particularly for disadvantaged groups who have a lot going on. And so this has to be seen in relation to decades of research on similar housing mobility programs, and more importantly, decades of ethnographic research from people like Elijah Anderson, who've done work showing the importance of violence, Mary Petillo showing the how proximity to areas of extreme disadvantage affects the life chances of kids. Stephanie's work showing just the constraints at the low end of the private rental market and how moves are made very quickly in reaction to a crisis where the family is trying to find a safe block that will pass an inspection. And that's it. That's the primary concern. So these insights have come from a large body of ethnographic work. And, you know, if we're going to design policy, one of the things that I love about the Seattle Project is that they brought in Stephanie, who can start to understand what's actually going on in families' lives. And this has been done in Baltimore. This is now being done in Seattle. Stephanie has worked in Alabama and elsewhere. And this is where we have learned the most. It's the experiment has been enormously valuable, but to understand what has actually been going on, I at least personally have relied on what Stephanie has found and Kathy Eden and Laura Tack and a lot of other ethnographers who have done this research.
So I think that's a nice segue, actually, to put it back to Jeff. The paper that Jens presented that you worked on is really trying to reconcile some of the differences in the MTO research, so this experimental program, with the observational research. And you guys sort of rule out a couple of those. So the MTO research finds that for adults, at least, there aren't significant improvements in labor market outcomes. And some of the observational research has found that families that move to low poverty neighborhoods do better in the labor market, right? So this was some of the puzzles you're trying to resolve. You sort of rule out some hypotheses and back into this, very economist-like conclusion that the difference is self-selection on unobservables. So when you do observational research and you see that families move to low-poverty neighborhoods and they do better, those families are somehow different than the families who didn't move. And MTO essentially gets people to move who wouldn't have moved without the experimental program. So it sounds like, some of the things Stephanie's telling us are giving us a hint of what some of the unobservables are. So things like family credit history, or have they had a traumatic experience in their past, or is there some trauma in the recent present that's causing them to move very quickly? So I'm curious, as you're listening to the results that come out of the CMTO, and especially some of this ethnographic research, does that give you any sort of different insights on either the difference between MTO and the observational studies, or a different way that we can think about, this sort of self-selection on unobservables, which is often kind of opaque to non-economists?
So I have a somewhat different take on that issue. I think of it as there are ways in which moving to Nathan's high opportunity areas have effects on some outcomes and not on other ones. And so the work you're referring to is really about adult economic self-sufficiency, earnings in the labor market and such. And there's a lot of other outcomes that are interesting and important, and some of them don't have that same feature. So we think that the individual characteristics of the adults were very important for labor market outcomes. The effect of living in a high opportunity area seems to be pretty big for adult health outcomes, for the kids' earnings, especially when they moved when they were young, and so on. So I think of the story as being a lot about it's important to have an idea of what outcomes you're interested in and understanding those channels. And with respect to the importance of the ethnography that Pat was talking about, I think of it as being more of an iterative process. And so Stephanie alluded to this, where we did some surveys, we did some in-person semi-structured interviews, then we did some more surveys, then we did some more semi-structured in-person interviews, and then we did some more surveys. And so each time we're going along, we're learning more about, we should have more survey questions on health, because we learned some things that we didn't know at the beginning. And we should have a much richer module on criminal victimization, because that's a really important thing that wasn't in the congressional authorizing legislation, but is super important to the families. And so it was really that iteration that I felt like was the place where we were learning the most.
So
can I jump in on that, on the adult outcomes? So I think that the interpretation, I'm glad that you mentioned the other outcomes, because I often get lost in favor of a focus on economic self-sufficiency. But when we think about explaining the children's outcomes, we have to look to the parents. Because the mental health improvements and maybe some of the health improvements are things that we saw from our qualitative work in Baltimore helped parents parent more effectively. So I think parents are still benefiting in ways, as Jeff mentioned, but those benefits help us explain how children end up benefiting, right? That those mechanisms are key. So I think that, you know, focus tends to get lost as well, because explaining children's the increase in children's earnings, or, you know, the chances of them going to college, right? We can explain both through the direct neighborhood effects, but we can also explain through the benefits for parents in their kind of a parenting dividend from also being in safer neighborhoods.
So I want to try to unpack a little bit what we mean when we talk about high opportunity neighborhoods. So as you explained, you guys have a very specific definition, in large part because of how you're able to identify them. Neighborhoods that 30 years ago produced kids with higher earnings as adults, right? So that's in part a technical definition because of what you have available. But I think for sort of policy questions and understanding this, it would be really helpful to know what's different about high opportunity neighborhoods and low opportunity neighborhoods, particularly ones that are sort of, you know, the rent is the same, but some seem to do better for kids than others. And pointing out also that the original MTO program incentivized families to move, or required them to move, to low poverty neighborhoods, which is not necessarily the same thing as a high opportunity neighborhood. So I'm curious, you know, from any of you, either based on these papers or your other research, when we talk about high opportunity neighborhoods, what's special about them?
All right. So I think that I can start on this. I think there's still a lot of work to obviously be done to understand what is the kind of secret sauce in a high opportunity area that is missing, quote unquote, or under invested in lower opportunity areas. And I don't think we know the answer to that. If you take all the observables we can find really in the census and try to just run a kind of a regression of trying to predict high versus low opportunity areas using things like the poverty rates, the best R-squared you can really get out of that is like 50-60%. And there's just an enormous amount of variation that we just don't really understand. And some of the strongest predictors are things like the fraction of two-parent households and the number of people that return their census forms. The types of things that we don't think is actually a causal, like, that's not the secret sauce. That's something that's like what it smells like, right? And so we're trying to figure out, you know, what exactly is it in these neighborhoods that drives those patterns. And so I think we don't know. And so then I think, you know, the second thing here, and I think this comes back a little bit to the discussion of what are we trying to do with the policy? Are we trying to improve kids' outcomes? Are we trying to improve adult outcomes? In some cases, like in the mechanisms that Stephanie was alluding to, those could be very much aligned, that if you improve the mental health of parents, perhaps you're having spillover effects onto kids. But perhaps there are other trade-offs. If there are other types of experiments, say, you know, if you're pairing with Jobs Plus type programs and you have to be close to employment, maybe those aren't the same neighborhoods where the types of infrastructures for children are the strongest. I don't know. I think there's a lot to be unpacked to really understand those. But I think the one thing we are learning is that neighborhoods are very multidimensional. One example I can give you concretely there is that the types of neighborhoods that are more likely to induce children to go to college are not always the same ones that induce the highest earnings. There's actually orthogonal variation in those neighborhoods. And actually, if your child moves to the neighborhoods that have the higher college-going rates at an earlier age but no higher incomes, on average, are more likely to go to college and they don't have higher incomes. It's like we're sort of this product of the neighborhood environments we grew up in, this multidimensional type of environment that you're growing up that's shaping to a large extent your outcomes in adulthood. But what is doing it, I think, is the big open question.
I think the answer, we don't know enough yet, is something I would also say. But, you know, to this point, I mean, we're going to be following families in Seattle to ask them what has changed, you know, about the way that life looks for you now. Right, you starting broad like that and then waiting to hear how much of that has to do with the way parents interact with their communities and their children. But what I've always seen across many families in the cities that I've been in is the sort of adaptive strategic efforts parents put forward to take the advantages that they can from different kinds of neighborhoods and places where, you know, one neighborhood may provide work, another may be where childcare resides with an auntie, and then, you know, there's the neighborhood where you and your children sleep at night. And so I think there's, to Nathan's point, quite a bit of patchwork parenting and strategy going on that does complicate some of these simple answers. But sure, you know, it certainly shouldn't emphasize how much work parents are doing actually to try and put all these benefits together.
And just one thing that I think is well established at this point is that violence undermines communities in a way that I think is impossible to ignore and is present in every ethnography of urban poverty and disadvantage, and it does so by undermining investment, both, you know, investment of families, whether families are willing to buy a house to raise children in a community, business owners, whether they're willing to set up shop, members of core community institutions like schools, whether teachers are willing to invest in a school district, whether people are willing to venture out into public space and take advantage of libraries and other amenities and be out in public space. And so that comes out of ethnography, and that's also, I think, been strongly supported in quantitative work as well. So I don't want to leave the impression that we know nothing about what creates strong, thriving communities. One thing we do know is that that is impossible if public spaces are unsafe. Now, there's a lot more that has to go on to develop the kind of core institutions that can make sure that every kid has a place to go, that families have support networks, and so forth. But I think that is the starting point. It's very hard for places to thrive if public spaces are unsafe.
So I just want to echo the importance of safety, and Jens talked about this a bit at the end of his presentation. It really was one of the things that was the most striking to us early on. So like the paper that he was alluding to, one of the first papers we wrote, which is now like over 20 years ago, was called Bullets Don't Got No Name. And so this paper was really about the stories of families that we sat down with. And this woman's story was about how she really kept her kids inside because she didn't really know when that bullet was going to find her kid. But those bullets were out there, and they might get her kid at any time. And so those kinds of things were sort of the anecdotes that were underlying the very broad measures of safety that we were capturing in the surveys, and we think are very important parts of the mental health effects that we saw were important causal effects of moving to higher opportunity areas. So that's a way in which we think of that story as all fitting together.
So we can use tools like the Opportunity Atlas to help identify neighborhoods that at least historically have been high opportunity. Once we find these neighborhoods, presumably we'd like to help as many people as possible have the opportunity to move there if they want to. And the CMTO research is starting to show us that we can think of the sort of barriers to moving into these high opportunity neighborhoods, both at the family level, so things like they have poor credit, they're having a hard time finding a landlord to rent to them, they've have difficult personal circumstances or financial circumstances, so kind of family specific, but there are also sort of broader neighborhood or market or institutional barriers, and we can actually think about something like, you know, the landlord's unwillingness to rent to a Section 8 voucher holder as an institutional barrier. So as we think about kind of policy solutions, could we think about the kinds of interventions that we would do at the family level and the kinds of policies that might be effective at a broader level, at a neighborhood or market or, you know, a sort of a housing market level that would be helpful? Take either one of those or both.
So I'm going to take the landlord piece on this because we, while we've been talking to families for the last while, we've also been talking to landlords in Baltimore, Cleveland, Dallas, D.C., and we'll be talking to landlords in Seattle as well. And there's some really interesting things that you find, you know, for effective policies have in common when, you know, helping families move and helping convince landlords to take voucher holders. And I think treating people with respect and dignity is a key piece of that. So that's one of the things we talk about in the paper about CMTO is just families feel a lot of support and they feel like their choices and their vision for their future matters. And that's part of what's so compelling about the Navigators. Landlords also want to be treated well. And so we talked to nearly 160 landlords in Baltimore, Dallas, and Cleveland, and we asked them, this is work supported by HUD and the Annie E. Casey Foundation in partnership, we asked landlords why they didn't take voucher holders. The interesting thing was that nearly two-thirds of the landlords we had spoken to previously had rented to voucher holders, which means that maybe they'd do it again, right? Why weren't they renting to voucher holders? And there's been work, you know, at the Urban Institute on this as well, on the pervasiveness of landlord discrimination. But things came up like not having someone to talk to at the housing authority, not having someone to answer the phone when you have a question about paperwork or bureaucracy. The bureaucracy itself, if you've never failed an inspection, why are you having to go through one every single year? Why the inspections seem capricious, unfair, and unpredictable? And this just drives landlords crazy. Will it be the fact that the screen door has a crack, but the storm door itself is perfectly sturdy and the inspection fails? They hate this, right? And, you know, one thing we learned from the Baltimore Mobility Program, and there are folks here, Pete and Adria, who are running this. I think Allison is somewhere in the on the phone, who previously worked in Baltimore, found very similar things. And so staff were dedicated, like they are in Seattle, to helping build relationships with landlords to understand what they need, how to get it. And then also to be able to bridge the divide between what landlords think about voucher holders if they've never rented to them and who voucher holders really are by having, you know, families create rental resumes to help explain who they are and why that might be that mark on their credit history. You know, providing landlords with damage guarantee funds that hardly ever get used by saying, look, we get that you're a business person and we respect that. So if something happens, we understand, we got that, we can cover you if you're willing to rent to a family. These are really compelling things to say to landlords, and over 4,000 households have moved in the Baltimore region to opportunity neighborhoods, right? And so it's possible to do this by building relationships with landlords, and I think that can benefits not just families who are moving with mobility programs, but families in general in our rental market. We don't do enough to support the folks who own the properties that house our poorest families, and we are increasingly relying on the private market to do this job. So we really need to understand better how to do it. And this, I think, may come as a surprise to many in the room who may see landlords as money-grubbing, profit-making jerks. You know, which is a narrative out there. It's the exception in our fieldwork. Landlords are people too. And many can't believe how they've ended up ever having to ask someone to leave a property. So I don't pretend to paint a picture of all of them as being a kind-hearted and altruistic, but you'd be surprised how many are. But more importantly, how many are reasonable business folks who are wanting to work with a program that understands that?
In terms, so we're here to talk about this program, Moving Opportunity, which was designed by Marge Turner and others because of a problem of concentrated poverty. And I do think it, in addition to thinking about this policy intervention and related interventions, we should at least say out loud the broader historical context, which all of you know, but it's worth just acknowledging it. So over the past 50 years and much longer, of course, our primary response, so instead of investing to deal with core social challenges like concentrated poverty and joblessness and violence and segregation and racial conflict and social unrest and the things that, and climate change, the things that started to become most visible in cities really in the 60s and 70s, We have instead taken an approach where we have allowed and, in fact, subsidized advantaged segments of the population to remove themselves, to separate themselves from those social problems, to establish barriers, barricades, sometimes physical barricades in space. And by this, I'm talking about land use regulations. I'm talking about gated communities, but I'm also talking about forming new governments, exclusive school districts. I'm talking about the whole array of mechanisms that have been used to allow segments of the population to distance themselves from those social problems, okay? And this has been subsidized for the past 50 years by social policy. This has been our response to those problems, the establishment of these barricades. And so these policies are designed to quarantine problems in particular areas, to isolate advantage segments from those areas, and to restrict access. Who can access these areas of opportunity? So while we're talking about programs that can be thought of as ways to scale those barricades, to allow small numbers of people to move beyond, to jump over those barricades that divide every inch of American soil, we also have to think not just about improving the places behind the barricades, but about tearing those barricades down. And that gets us into discussions about land use policy. That gets us into discussions. You know, Jenny is an expert in housing, and all of my ideas about housing come from you. So, you know, it would be good if you could chime in on what are some of those ideas. But transit investment, making sure that every jurisdiction is forced to build affordable housing, even if they have no desire to do so, ending the home mortgage interest deduction. You know, these are policy domains that I think everybody in the room knows are essential, but, you know, we don't want to limit our focus. So it's fantastic to help people access areas of opportunity, and that's really valuable. And the Seattle project is incredibly promising and encouraging, and I love it. But we also have to always have to keep this broader discussion about how do we tear down those barricades while we have this discussion about allowing larger numbers to overcome them, to scale them.
I'm so excited you brought up zoning. That wasn't a plant, but it's timely. So let's talk about one of the ways to create more available neighborhoods is just to make sure that there are rental apartments within whatever HUD's willingness to pay the rent available in lots of these areas. And I'd be curious to know from the work that you guys did with individual families, with landlords, doing outreach, how hard was it to find apartments within the FMR standard for people to apply to? Were there neighborhoods that you would have loved people to be able to go move to and there was just nothing there?
I mean, that's a pretty good question, and I think actually we could almost defer it to the next panel and have Sarah answer that one. I'm staring at her right now, who's in Seattle. Yeah, right? I'll punt the good ones down the line. I think, you know, are there particular places that were sort of excluded? I think there's a lot of, you know, there's generally a shortage of housing in Seattle as far as, that's basically the uniform response when we talk with people there. It's like, my goodness, this housing market is so tough. And you hear that in so many cities. And I think that then speaks to the policies of, you know, and the questions of should we be allowing localities to be making those decisions when the impacts are on all of us and on the national scale. I think that's the fundamental tension we face when opportunity and opportunity for kids is inherently local, is inherently about neighborhoods, is inherently likely driven by decisions that are happening inside of neighborhoods. And those implications are implications for children who grow up and live throughout the country, pay tax revenue or don't pay as much tax revenue. I think these kinds of effects really affect us all, but they're decisions that are occurring at the local level. That's sort of a classic case for sort of an externality where you get where exactly the kind of barriers that Pat's talking about to arise, and I think that is a big issue that is sort of coming to its forefront. specific recommendations on what we should do about it. I think that's a tougher set of things because presumably there's benefits to allowing local decision makers to make good decisions in their communities and to have stakes in their communities. But these are the kinds of trade-offs we have to work through.
So I want us to think a little bit about the extent to which this program could be scaled. And let's pretend for the moment that resources aren't a constraint. So assume that, or financial resources aren't a constraint, right? So finances aren't the only problem that we'd run into. So one question is, are there going to be apartments available in all of the communities you want and enough apartments to absorb more people? I think another question is, what would this program look like if you scaled it up? You know, there were, 300 families who were part of this. The Seattle Housing Authority administers, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of vouchers. Would it be possible for Seattle and King County to provide the same sort of family-level counseling and services and assistance matching to apartments to everybody who has a voucher? Is that something that's feasible to scale? Is that something that's just not going to work if you open it up to the whole housing authority?
So, I mean, I think there, you know, it's one of the questions, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't all be here thinking about how this could possibly be done where we live. I mean, I think, you know, what does scaling mean, right? Does that mean we're going to offer enough, you know, assistance for all voucher holders to move, right? I mean, there are lots of reasons to think that might not be the best strategy. But if, you know, finances aren't an issue, I mean, I think we want to focus on creating a good program. I mean, I think that one of the things that works so well in Seattle is you have high functioning housing authorities who have high functioning partners who really built a terrific program that's working really well for families who struggle as much as any family I've met in Baltimore or Cleveland or anywhere else. So, I mean, I think if we talk about scaling and we immediately think, are there enough units? You know, I think, can we make good programs? And, different cities and localities are going to have challenges with that because, you know, some of the staff at housing agencies I've talked to in different cities say, well, we're trying to do the voucher program already just by itself, and that's hard. Or we're trying to figure out how to manage some of the properties we have. That's hard enough. So I think we want to, you know, figure out institutional capacity, and then we want to figure out how to design really high-quality programs. I mean, that's the first thing, or at least a parallel thing to consider in the idea of scaling up. I mean, but, you know, again, I'll turn to the Baltimore program, that I've been talking to families from that program for a long time, and, you know, nearly, 4,000 households have moved across the central Maryland area over 16 years, I think, if I've got some of those numbers about right. Pete, I don't know, you probably have symbolic, the more updated numbers, which is extraordinary. Impossible. It happened. People found a way to do it. Landlords said yes. So I think there are lots of things that are possible and reasons to be optimistic, but we want to say, do we want that to be the policy, right? To some of Pat's points and also to your expertise, Jenny. But also, let's figure out how to develop good programs where we decide to scale. I don't think I can emphasize that enough.
With respect to the scale, I think it's pretty clear that one could have a national program that was in hundreds of cities rather than five demonstration cities and had a budget that was billions of dollars as opposed to a demonstration that's on the order of $70 million. That still is a long way from completely unconstrained budgetary resources and serving every person who was possibly eligible, but that is much bigger than the demonstrations that have occurred, and so like orders of magnitude bigger. So there's a lot of room to scale that I think pretty clearly could be scaled, and then there's also some limits beyond that.
Like, this may be asking you guys to get outside of sort of your comfort zone, your expertise, but both MTO and CMTO were done in select cities, so Seattle, Baltimore, so there are a handful of cities. If HUD were thinking about replicating this in other cities, are there lessons for the kinds of cities where this would be more easier to replicate or be more likely to succeed? either in terms of the housing authority, the housing market, the neighborhood characteristics. I mean, one of the distinct features of Seattle is the demographics there look really different than in a lot of other cities, right? West Coast cities, Midwest, Northeast cities look pretty different. Does that have implications for where we could do something like this and have it work?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that. I mean, I think it is coming outside of our comfort zone, but I'll try to step out there. I think, you know, one of the key features, I think, of the experiment in Seattle, for example, and I think was a feature of MTO as well, was the key feature in Seattle is the main program was very tailored to each individual. And so when we talk about high quality, it's like each family sort of got what they needed out of the program. And that requires, I think, a degree of motivation by the parties involved in the program to execute that. And so I think there is an important design question for how do we ensure that type of quality throughout an expansion. And I think that's always the case with many expansions of government services. And I think that's an important question whenever we think about a scale. I think in the MTO, if I recall, there was some site heterogeneity in the extent to which the experiment itself was implemented, and then also in the outcomes as well, which, you know, I think unfortunately, because it only got to five sites and it didn't have the second round that was originally planned, we don't know what the general characteristics are of places that succeed at this versus don't. And I think that is really important to understand. You want to be able to trace out that scaling path and understand, you know, who should be doing this, who shouldn't be doing this, and if they can't do it, what needs to change in order for them to do it. I think, unfortunately, we're not there now, but I do think we're excited with the number of partners that have been excited about doing this type of work, like what we've been doing up in Seattle, and are hopeful that we can try to generate that library over time. But it is very important, and it's not something we know now.
Do you want to say just quickly sort of where other cities are, where you guys are working or planning to work?
Yeah, so we have partners that are in Chicago. There's folks that MDRC has been working with there in Chicago and working with us in St. Louis. Milwaukee has been in discussions. New York has been in discussions with us. I think there's a broad sort of coalition of folks, broadly MTW agencies that have a lot more flexibility in what they're able to do, that have sort of been at the table and said, hey, we'd be very interested in trying to do things along these lines. I think the extent to which, you know, what each site is actually going to be engaged in, I think, is an ongoing set of discussions, so I don't want to put any particular housing authority out on the spot of like, oh, they're going to do this and they're going to do that. But I think there is enormous excitement that is out there in the housing authority space that we're excited to build on.
So I want to come back to a point that Jens made in his presentation, which is that even if we could manage to scale up the treatment for voucher holders or maybe even for all housing authority clients, there are going to be a lot of people who aren't going to get this treatment, right? I mean, even in your program with very intensive kind of counseling, was it 45% of the treatment families stayed in, you know, what you're defining as not high opportunity neighborhoods? In MTO, the percentage was even higher, right? So a lot of families are not going to move to the areas that are on the Opportunity Atlas map. What should we be doing to make neighborhoods better for people who are staying? I'm expecting you to solve all neighborhood problems in the next 20 minutes.
So I'm going to take the second part of the question, actually, and just maybe clarify a few things that get misunderstood. So with the original MTO take-up rates hovering at 50% or lower in some cities, a number of critics have interpreted that as saying, you know, families, those were families who chose not to move, who didn't want to move. And I think it's easy when you see, you know, low policy take-up rates or apparent policy failure to look for individual explanations and overstate the durability of preferences for low-income or low-opportunity neighborhoods. We talked to lots of families in the Baltimore site of MTO to try to understand a bit more why it is that the take-up rate was low and what you know, why it seemed that so many families moved back to higher poverty neighborhoods. And I think, you know, the first thing I'll say is that the MTO families didn't receive a fraction of the support that the CMTO families received, and were having to use a voucher that was extraordinarily limited. The policy itself is quite limited. There was no source of income no source of income protection against discrimination by landlords in any of the sites. And you had, as far as I know, you know, payment standards weren't high enough. There was no help with security deposits. You know, it's difficult to use vouchers across jurisdictions. Families had to apply to multiple housing authorities. So I could go on. But so one thing to clarify, just whenever those take-up rates come up, is that it's difficult to use the voucher with some modest counseling. I think families who did move, when we spoke with them, you know, many talked about how they enjoyed the safety that Pat and Jeff and Jens have talked about, and didn't want to move out of safer neighborhoods. But because landlords sold properties, they had to, and they had no help. And then, you know, a limited voucher. There are housing quality failures. And so there were quick moves that had to happen. Families changed size. They had to move. And again, there was no support, and families were forced to move in a rental market that, you know, was far less hospitable to voucher holders than it is even today. And so I think that it's important to talk about that take-up rate as being not evidence so much of families not wanting to move, and therefore that's a reason to think about how many that wouldn't be served. So that's an important clarification. I think in Seattle, the take-up rate's interesting. We're looking still, at least in the qualitative data, and I'm sure that some of the program data, still to understand that. But what we heard from families that we talked to, you know, it was a number of immigrant families who understood perfectly well the benefits that the navigators explained to them about moving to opportunity neighborhoods, but had deep community ties that, you know, involved work. Some were home healthcare workers. Some had very limited English skills and were relying on friends to help broker leases with landlords as it was. And then, you know, also there were some families who had just leased up somewhere and didn't want to even think about breaking that lease and moving. So anyway, the take-up rates are complex. And so I wanted to just put that out there by way of just talking a little bit about that.
Another thing I'll say is that I think one of the goals of the work that we've been doing is to try to learn some about what Nathan referred to as the secret sauce. And to the extent that you think part of the secret sauce is safety, then you can either move to it or try to create it. And so there are a lot of tools to try to create it, whether it's policing policy or after-school programs or some of the catalog that Jens mentioned. That's a way in which you can think of what this research is telling us about place to give you a direction for where to focus one's energy to try to create some of those conditions.
I want to make sure you get a chance to chime in. So crime is one of your specialty areas. One thing we know that's different about cities and neighborhoods is that crime was much higher all across the U.S. in the 1990s when MTO was launched than it is today. Does that make a difference for how we should expect kids to grow up in neighborhoods today? I mean, even the kids who don't get a chance to move, do we expect there to be sort of a substantial improvement in everybody's outcomes?
Absolutely, I expect that. I mean, the problem of concentrated poverty looked entirely different in the early 1990s than it does now, because in most major cities, violent crime has plummeted. And so concentrated poverty means something very different now, not everywhere, but in New York, LA, San Diego, DC, not as much in Baltimore, which still has the same level of violence that it had 25 years ago. So this, you know, leads to the question then, should we see if violence is as important as I've argued it is, and other people have suggested it is as well, then should we see these major changes in what it means to grow up in disadvantaged neighborhoods? And in fact, when you look at the data, we have seen those changes. So in the places where violence has fallen the most academic achievement has improved the most. There's very strong evidence for long-term gains in economic mobility. You have the basic outcome of life expectancy. So life expectancy has improved dramatically for segments of the population that were hit hardest by violent crime and continue to be hit hardest by violent crime, most notably black men. Okay, life expectancy of black men is still way lower than white men and white and black women. And there's a huge gap that remains, but it has shot up the most. Okay, and you can, in a mechanical way, you can look at how the decline of violence has affected life expectancy. And I find in my work that this has probably been the most important public health advancement of the past several decades. So for black men in particular. So I think, you know, the expectation is that the drop in violence should change the meaning of concentrated poverty. And in fact, it has. It doesn't mean it has made concentrated poverty unimportant. We have new challenges. The housing crisis has worsened in the past 25 years. Economic inequality has worsened in the past 25 years. We have a whole host of new challenges that are present in cities, and poverty is not any easier than it was 25 years ago, but it looks very different.
So I'm going to give the panelists one last round of questions and then open it up to you guys so you can start thinking about your questions. So for each of you, we've learned a lot from both of these programs, from these demonstrations, from going back and reanalyzing the data. If you could pick one or two sort of top knowledge gaps, questions we don't yet know the answer to that you think are really important, particularly for making decisions about policy, about where to invest our resources, what don't we know that we need to find out moving forward?
So I think the secret sauce, I guess I'll come back to here. I mean, I think we do know that certain things do matter. So there is good evidence that increased spending on schools, for example, and crime do have a causal role in promoting upward mobility. But I think we don't have a sense of what drives the dramatic variation across the United States in mobility that we do see.
One of the hardest things to study, which is I think why we perhaps know the least about it, is what is the effect on a receiving neighborhood when new families move into it. So they're such a small part of such a big thing, it's really hard to tease out. And it could be that the controlling factor is really the plurality and they have very little influence on it, or it could be that the effects are very nonlinear and they could have a very big effect, and we really have not had a good way of sorting that out. That's one of the things that's I would identify.
Which matters a lot for the scaling question. If we're going to send many more people to some of the receiving neighborhoods, what does that do to the receiving neighborhood?
Okay, so I think there's still a lot of work to be done on understanding exactly what generates those that variation that Nathan pointed to on the map of Seattle or any city where there's this huge variation within cities in upward mobility in places that don't look, at least at the surface level, all that different. So I think that's generative of our research agenda to figure out exactly what's going in. And we have some hints, we have some starting points, but I think that's a next phase, and thankfully Nathan and Raj Shetty and the team at Opportunity Insights make this data public, so we can get to work and try to figure it out. So that's one key item on a research agenda. I think a second one, you know, we kind of dodged Jenny's question a little bit on what investments in communities are crucial to making sure the communities don't fall apart, the neighborhoods don't go downhill. And again, we have some hints and some ideas there, but I think that's a more general question. You know, if we're, I argue that we really need to think beyond an individual safety net and really think about community safety nets and how to make sure that every neighborhood has a set of institutions and organizations and public spaces that allow it to avoid going downhill when the next crisis hits, whatever that next crisis might be. And I think we don't have a precise set of ideas about what those investments might be. Okay, third, the political challenge is the huge one. When we start to think about how to tear down invisible barricades, how to deal with land use regulations, how to make sure communities build affordable housing, I think that, you know, we need guidance from the people who are trying to do this and have run into political obstacles to doing this. And so this involves legal scholars. This involves practitioners to figure out how to do this effectively.
I think it's not surprising we have some gaps in common, given that we're all interested in some of the same questions. I mean, the place-based question is something I've been thinking about for a long time. Quite some time ago, Alex Polakoff called me and said, how's Sandtown Winchester doing? And I was in the car, and he said, I think maybe you should take a look. And I said, well, Alex, I've got a bunch of other stuff going on, but why don't I just take some of the census data and take a look and, you know, a bird's eye view of Sandtown, Winchester, and West Baltimore and compare it to other similarly situated neighborhoods in Baltimore in the 1990s when Sandtown got, you know, by our calculation, lowball estimate, $130 million in an 8x9 block neighborhood to deal with housing, some education, workforce training. There's a lot we don't know about the investments made in Sandtown. And so, it was a dark day to have to release the report through the Able Foundation to say that at least, the way we compared neighborhoods in Baltimore who hadn't gotten that money, Sandtown didn't look all that much better. Home ownership increased quite a bit between 1990 and 2010, but so did foreclosure right after that, which, you know, got me thinking about how vulnerable neighborhoods like Sandtown Winchester are. When we think about place space, is it that we, you know, invest in the neighborhoods that need it most, which was the motivation by Jim Rouse and others to invest in Sandtown. But, you know, during this period, the labor market in Baltimore became no more favorable to people without a college degree. The aggressive policing tactics in Baltimore were at a peak. And all the neighborhoods around Sandtown were high poverty as well. So it was tricky. I haven't stopped thinking about it. We're looking at development strategies in 16 neighborhoods in Baltimore right now, different kinds of partnerships, public and private, to see whether it's possible for communities to have amenities. Folks have been waiting 25 years, like those in Berkeley. So that's, you know, work in progress. I'm not able to know for sure what we'll see, but it's difficult work and we need to do more of it. The measurement issues are difficult. We tend to really follow money that gives individuals benefits. We follow that money really carefully, but we don't always follow money that's invested in communities the same way with research. And we definitely need to do that. So I think, you know, part of my agenda and one that I would encourage is increasingly trying to understand the payoff to place-based strategies. I know Laura Tack and Pat and you guys and I think Nathan and Raj are also working on trying to pinpoint the payoff to those kinds of investments so we can learn a bit more using some of the tax data. So I think it's a big research agenda. Item. I love Baltimore, even though it's a tough place to live right now. And I think we can't just shrink it. We can't just solve our problems by shrinking cities. So how do we do something better? The other thing I've been thinking a lot about is just how this is, you know, really basic urban social question. You know, how do people measure and interact with their neighborhoods? And doing work in Seattle was really influential in rethinking this on my part, because living in Baltimore and being on a block face and you walk out of the street and there's lots of folks, you know, running around and you interact with neighbors, a lot of the affordable developments in Seattle, your neighbors are part of that complex. We saw some of this in Dallas as well. So how, you know, folks define neighborhoods and then how they interact with it is something, you know, to the secret sauce a bit, you know, something we want to, I think, go back to basics a little bit and try to think about that. And I'm also thinking, you know, about some of your earlier work, Pat, on street efficacy and how young people engage with neighborhoods and how we select what we want to avoid and what we want to go toward. And so these are sort of two offerings of things that I've been thinking a lot about that we should, number one, we should do a better job. And number two, we should maybe revisit and do that research agenda again.
Great. All right. So if you're interested in raising a question, asking a question, raise your hand. We have some staff circulating with microphones. Make sure you speak into the microphone if you can. Identify who you are, who you're with. And as David Elwood used to say, please ask your question in the form of a question that ends in a question mark.
Hi, Sam Dastrup from Apt Associates. I had a clarification on the Seattle work, on the timing, and specifically relative to the implementation of the zip code payment standard, the small area fair market rents, and more broadly, just wondered how important you thought that, you know, if I'm right and it was post smaller from ours, how important that is to have that higher rents in the higher zip, you showed some correlation. And so the question mark is, how important are the rents to the whole question?
Yeah, good question. So what he's referring to is that there's 5-tiered payment standards in the King County area and an additional bonus payment in the Seattle area for moving to an opportunity area, area that generally has higher rents. I think broadly what we see is that there's movement within each of the different tiers. So one of the things we see in King County is that they do move to more expensive neighborhoods, and that actually ends up increasing the kind of the net cost of the program. I think it's an open question on whether or not we would have seen as impactful moves. Like, did that enable a lot more families to move to Opportunity because it opened up some of the neighborhoods near Bellevue and things like that that were a little bit more expensive and kind of more traditionally thought of as good neighborhoods. And I think we don't know the answer of what the experiment would have looked like if they didn't have the tiered payment standards. Our sense, though, is that given the kind of uniformity in the distribution of moves within the opportunity areas, that there were a lot of places that were not actually the most expensive neighborhoods that a lot of families did choose to move to. So if you just simply threw those families sort of out of the data, the ones that went to the most expensive areas, you still would be seeing a significant effect given the strong effects that we're actually seeing. So I think we would have still seen an effect. How big it would have been, I think, is a harder question.
Mark?
Mark Schroeder, HUD. So I guess my question's for Nathan. And my question is this. When you showed your map of where the opportunity neighborhoods are in Seattle or the Seattle area, most of them were in the suburbs. There was a few of them in North Seattle, which happens to be where the University of Washington is located. So my question is, if you used a poverty line, but it was somewhat liberalized for the fact that the cost of living is much higher, even for poor people in Seattle, than it is in the rest of the country, would your neighborhoods not be essentially the same as the ones you have?
Yeah, it would be similar, so it was certainly correlated with the poverty rate, but that actually wasn't one of the stronger correlates. It's actually more strongly correlated, that map, with other variables like the fraction of two-parent households in the tract. But to answer the question more directly, it would basically be I think the correlation's right around 50%. So loosely, it's kind of you've picked up about half of that variation with the poverty rates, and you get an additional kicker with the others, with using the Opportunity Atlas, if that makes sense.
Yeah, let's go to the second row, third row here. Yeah.
Hi, Deborah Ray again from the University of Maryland. I just want to go back to my question regarding early learning centers. I'd like to know what kind of data you are collecting at the classroom level, where there might be more segregation that isn't identified at the school or the district level.
So I was thinking about your question, and I meant to address it. I can't answer that particular question, but I can say one thing, which is the the daycare center question comes into play when the navigators meet with families. So we haven't actively collected data on that yet. I think there's a lot of questions to still ask about what families, how they're benefiting, which family routines have changed and improved or gotten harder and all of that. But so one of the things that happens when families meet with the navigator is that they'll talk about what families need. What's your vision for what you'd like your life to be like? Where might you like to see yourself and your family living? Okay, let's talk about the different things that your kids need. Let's talk about daycare. Let's talk about after school activities. Let's talk about swimming pools. How about you, Mom? Do you want to go back to school? North Seattle Community College is not far. So those pieces come in at least on the front end as part of the package of families meeting with the navigators. So that's as much as, I was thinking about your question, I could come up with that where they feed in, but whether or not families then experience struggles because those daycare centers are different or not, we don't know yet.
On the aisle here. Yeah, the gentleman in the blue shirt.
My name is Mike Olash. I just want to ask, while you move people to an opportunity, more opportunity, or what actually happens in the community that they've left from? Does the quality of life deteriorate there, or does it stay the same, or does it probably doesn't get better? But
I think this was the open question that Jeff was proposing. I think we don't know the answer to that. I think one thing else, in the Seattle context, a lot of the families are not actually even coming from neighborhoods within, say, Seattle and kind of moving out to the suburbs. That's not exactly the model you want to necessarily have in your mind in this particular context. But I think the general spirit of the question is one that needs to be answered, and I don't think we have a solid sense from an academic standpoint.
If your question is about the neighborhoods that people were coming from, then that has to do a lot with the wait list for people who are trying to get into those units. So the public housing that a lot of the voucher holders are coming from itself has a long wait list. And when somebody leaves, then they tend to be replaced with somebody who was like them. And so it doesn't change the characteristics of the place that they're coming from in a material way because of the queuing to get into that area and to begin with.
Richard.
I've been trying to stop myself asking this question, and I failed. I'm not quite satisfied with the polite consensus that we seem to have arrived at in the balance between moving people out of areas and then what we do for the people left behind. The consensus seems to be we say, yes, we should move people out, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do lots of things for the people left behind. And we're all kind of that's how we get out of these conversations. But I'd like to ask, how would we know what was the right number of people then to move out? I think Pat just said we would want to move everybody out, obviously. And everyone says that. Okay. But it's been implied that we could move more people out than we do now. How would we know what was the optimum number to move out? Is it just a budgetary constraint, in which case the more the better? Is it however many people want to move out? Is it according to some algorithm for what would be the equitable thing to do? I just don't know. And my fear is that absent that conversation, this work, although it's not the intent, could be used almost as an argument against doing the things for the places left behind. It becomes a sort of social policy of escape committee. Look what happens. Look at these great things that happen to the people that move out. And so without that being the intent, it might actually play into a narrative which doesn't pay enough attention to the people left behind. So I just want to try and interrupt that politeness that I'm feeling a little bit right now. Like, just tell me what you really think.
I'm Betsy Julian from Dallas. And actually, I will be polite. But that position, as twilight as I can, That argument has been going on for a very, very long time. I think it's a good point. The answer is, how many people do we let move out? That really articulates it in a way that I think speaks to the problem historically. That's a really different, and you posited it differently, because when you don't want to really talk about letting people who've been contained by government policy be released from those constraints, then you talk about moving them out. Let's just stop for that. We would literally let every family who got the full navigator resources. I think one of the reasons Seattle is so important is the families were told what their options were, and the and what we're seeing is what they wanted to do writ large, you know, writ large. So I think if we start with nobody's moving anybody, they're saying you who have been contained can go, can try to access opportunities. If you've got a six-year-old child, you do not have to wait till we figure out the big answer to the question, what do you do about the place that is, quote, left behind. And I do think it's important to realize for voucher holders, many of these folks haven't been living in the communities they're living in. That's not their community. They live where they were able to find housing. It may not have been for more than a year. We have worked with over 4,000, 5,000 families over the past years in our program. It's not a research program, but the common themes are so real. People say, tell us where we can go. Where can we find housing? All the problems that Stephanie identifies are the real ones for the families. But given the chance, and I think the Seattle program has so much power because it said, with the kind of help, which is not rocket science, given that kind of help, those are the kind of choices people get to make. So the answer is, how many you let people go who want to go? That's, in fact, I would argue that the most important thing you can do for a community that is struggling with concentrated poverty and with the legacy of segregation is to start with letting people go who don't want to be there, because I don't think you fight the kind of battle that is involved in the most distressed communities with hostages. My experience has been working in those communities and working with families who want to get out and people who want to stay, is that what you really want is a core of really committed volunteers, oftentimes homeowners who have lived in that community forever, or people who have those ties. That is your social capital that you want to cash in on as you try to address those issues. So I really want to push back on the notion that anybody talks about these programs moving people out as if we pick them up and put them someplace, and if you're going to tell them they can't go because we decided socially it would be bad for the communities in which we have put them in the first place. I think that is a fundamental bad way to look at this, the idea of this issue of whether it's moving to advantaged communities, opportunity communities, or wherever people want to go, and where, if you will look honestly, where poor white people have always been able to access much more than poor people of color. But I did want to, before you asked the question, I wanted to ask Patrick a question.
Yeah, let me give the panel a quick chance to respond to see if anybody has a different answer.
I mean, so I thought that the perspective that you have in terms of how to think about both what we did in Seattle and the implications for policy, I think were incredibly well said. I think the only sort of thing I could say on the place-based front, I think from a research standpoint, we don't have the analogous MTO, as Stephanie was alluding to. We don't know what a thing we can kind of latch on to that is going to necessarily improve places. We do know that there's it's good to invest in schools, and we know it's good to do policies that reduce crime. I think there's a lot of other spaces and examples of place-based policies that are hard to really sort of put your finger on, oh, this worked or this didn't work. And I think, highlighting the potential for needing to explore place-based policies as well is not because I necessarily think they are going to be better or worse than quote-unquote choice-based policies. I think, as you rightly said, I think we should all have choice. We should all have the freedom to live where we would like to live and raise our children. And I think in a lot of ways this is a civil rights issue. But I think at the end of the day we also do want to have the body of research that we currently don't have for understanding what the impact of place-based policies are.
Can I ask Patrick the question I would have asked if it... there's no secret sauce, and I absolutely think we've got to figure out what we do about the communities that these families are choosing to want to either escape from because there's still families there. Is it crime? And our families always say safety, like yours, that is driving a lot of what they want. If you had to say what is the most important policy that would raise the floor, let's put aside this whole idea of getting to opportunity. Let's talk about getting kids at 6 years old or younger out of the most low opportunity, low opportunity in the world, the most disadvantaged places. Do we have a metric that says we're going to at least get kids out of this? While we work on building and improving the neighborhoods that are high poverty or considered disadvantaged in general, is there a silver bullet? I don't want to use that term, but is there a metric like crime? And Patrick, I think you, if we could just get the crime down to a metro-wide average in a neighborhood that is otherwise high poverty and has a lot of the other problems, do you think that would is that an important policy metric that to say we're going to get kids out of this if it's below this?
So I think it's the first order. It's the fundamental challenge. I think it's necessary. It's not sufficient in the sense that nothing else can happen when a place is violent. The types of people and organizations that are potentially going to invest in a community won't do it if a place is violent. And I don't mean, you know, just residents. I also mean business owners and other. So I do think it's the first order challenge, but certainly not sufficient. And, you know, when we talk about, I use Marge's term, place-conscious policies as opposed to place-based investments, because I do think there's a growing body of evidence, much of which comes from the crime lab in Chicago that Jens runs, but elsewhere, you know, this result of greening abandoned lots in Philadelphia, more and more well-designed studies looking at you know, not just Harlem Children's Zone, but similar organizations that take the perspective of looking out over a community. We have a growing body of evidence that suggests that if we invest in these kinds of organizations, or if a community sits on a foundation of strong organizations, then it's much less likely that that community is going to fall apart and go downhill. So beyond just saying, you know, every community needs to become safe, I do think if I were going to call for a general policy that could apply to every single neighborhood across the country, I would say invest in strong organizations and institutions in that community. And if every community sits on that foundation of strong organizations, I think there's much lower likelihood that people are going to fall through the cracks, that the neighborhood is going to fall apart.
And that's an excellent place to turn it over to our practitioner panel. So thank you to our panelists for being here today. And
Thanks again to the panelists and to Jenny for facilitating that conversation. Our next panel is going to focus more on the practical aspects, and that's going to be moderated by my colleague Alan Barubi, who is the Deputy Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program here in Brookings. So.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. Hi. I hope folks are able to stick around to hear from a panel that I think does a remarkable job, present company here excluded, from you know, traversing the research to policymaker to practitioner spectrum around the really critical design issues that we were hearing about in the last panel. So I'm just gonna get right into it and just say who I'm sitting up here with and what their titles are, but then I'll get them to say a little bit about themselves. So to my immediate left is Marge Turner. She's the Senior Vice President for Program Planning and Management at the Urban Institute here in Washington. Fulton Meacham next to Marge. He's the President and CEO of the Charlotte, North Carolina Housing Authority. And then to my far left, Saren Oppenheimer. She's the Director of Research and Evaluation for the King County, Washington Housing Authority. So I think everybody's full bios are in your packets, but I might just like to ask each of my fellow panelists to just say something about yourselves briefly, like if folks are reading your bio, like what might they not discover about you that relates to today's discussion on MTO, capital MTO, lowercase MTO, and assisted housing mobility more generally. Marge?
So I think
my bio is clear. I have been a policy researcher for most of my career, from almost all of it at the Urban Institute. And the focus of my work has been on housing discrimination, housing segregation, why it matters, and what we ought to be doing about it. In the 90s, I was a political appointee at HUD and helped design and launch the capital M, capital T, capital O demonstration, which was an incredible honor to be able to do.
Yeah, Pat kind of gave that away on the last panel. Fulton?
Fulton Meacham, CEO of the Charlotte Housing Authority. What you may not know is I've actually been the CEO of Pittsburgh, too. Both of these agencies are MTW agencies, moving to work agencies, which allows a great deal of flexibility and creativity. Focus has always been on how to move people in, up, and out of poverty. Concentrate a lot in supportive services and wraparound services for our residents to find pathways out of poverty.
Great. And Sarah?
Is that working? Okay. Sarah Oppenheimer. So I actually was a relative newcomer to Housing Authority work. Oftentimes I think people come to Housing Authorities and there's such rich information to know. So I had a lot of catch up to do and I came there about 6 years ago. KCAJ is also an MTW Housing Authority, which means there's a lot of exciting innovation. And so I have this very cool job of being able to evaluate that and figure out who are very smart, cool researchers that we can do applied research with. And so one of the first projects I began working on when I came to the Housing Authority was starting to build out what our applied research agenda would look like related to mobility, as well as our place-based efforts. And just want to say, I feel so grateful that there is a practice panel up here. It's really exciting. There were many moments throughout the day where I'm like, oh, I think it would be great to say something on it. And I was so reassured that our research colleagues, they had all, because we've been collaborating so closely, they were able to answer a lot of those practice-based questions, which was fantastic, and it's exciting to see it come full circle in this
panel.
Yeah,
actually, as a moderator, I thought maybe I should just, like, at 55 minutes, open it up to Fulton and Sarah and just say, feel free to respond to all of the questions that arose for you guys in the first couple hours of the event. But I'll try to be a little bit more structured about it. So maybe I can start with you, Marge, and ask you, as a housing researcher, a former policymaker, and just like an extraordinary human being, how do you think about and describe the kind of the wider context for the discussion around the new findings around capital M, capital T, capital O, capital C, capital M, capital T, capital O? Which, again, I think the last panel began to allude to, but I think you're a great authority
Thanks.
On this, too.
Thanks, Ellen. I do want to build on the themes Pat started to raise in the last panel and really broaden this conversation out so it encompasses the larger context of racial segregation and injustice within which assisted housing mobility policies really need to be considered. So I'm going to say, I perhaps even more bluntly than Pat did, that we, the United States, systematically and intentionally built separate and unequal neighborhoods. We did it through public policies. We did it through individual action. We did it through institutional practices. We excluded people of color from the neighborhoods that offered amenities and opportunities. And we starved the neighborhoods in which people of color were concentrated, trapped, consigned to live, of public and private resources and investments. And the consequences over decades have been profound for the long-term economic prospects of children growing up in those neighborhoods, for people's physical and mental health, but not just for individuals. It's for the persistence of racial prejudice and polarization in our country and the persistence of fear among us on all sides of the line. So we know that that history of racial segregation produced poverty concentration. And in more recent years, we've been seeing an increase in economic segregation. And a lot of the conversation in the first panel sort of seemed to be talking about economic segregation as if it didn't have anything to do with this history of racial segregation. And I don't want to suggest that the two are just the same thing, but you really can't think about them independently. I don't think we would have poverty concentration and neighborhood distress if we had not intentionally and systematically and effectively built separate and unequal neighborhoods. So we've been talking today mostly about the promise and potential of assisted housing mobility programs, who benefits and at what cost, and what it takes to make them effective. And I think that's a really important conversation to have. I really believe that these programs play an important role. I mean, I've spent a lot of my career figuring out what role they can play and also how we can advance them. So I think they're incredibly important for the participating families, but not just for the participating families, for helping us break down the patterns of racial segregation and poverty concentration that we so effectively built. But we can't think that assisted housing mobility programs, no matter how we scaled them, can do it by themselves. We really have to think of them as one tool in a broader toolkit that advances interconnected, not competing strategies of restoring the well-being and access to opportunity in historically distressed neighborhoods. And I tend to agree that it starts with safety, safety from the police as well as from criminals. But I agree with Pat, that's necessary but not sufficient. I think we need to think about how to preserve affordable housing in neighborhoods that are changing, even if they're not opportunity rich right away. If they appear to be becoming opportunity rich, we have to make sure that we're preserving the affordable housing options that are there. And we need to expand access to opportunity rich neighborhoods for people living in distressed communities. And again, that's more than a mobility program. We tend to focus so much on the behavior of the low-income people, their preferences, their choices, their failures in moving to the kind of neighborhood we think they should live in. We need to focus at least as much attention on the behaviors, the exclusionary policies, and the exclusionary practices of the people who live in opportunity-rich neighborhoods, and that is most of us. So I'll stop there, but I welcomed the let's stop being so polite invitation and felt like we ought to be explicit.
Good, let's get nasty. No, I'm joking. So for folks who haven't spent a ton of time in Charlotte or in Seattle, King County, I just wanted to ask Fulton and Sarah to say a little bit about sort of what your communities look like from the standpoint of the clients you serve and how much they do or don't resemble the sort of separate and unequal landscape that Marge was describing characterizes a lot of metropolitan America.
Charlotte, southern city, population somewhere 800,000, and we have this crescent of poverty, right? So you have north, south, east, and west. The crescent really is from east to west. High opportunity areas are predominantly south and north. East and west part of the community is predominantly African American. The housing developments in which we manage, again, high concentrations of poverty there as well. Luckily, we've been able to get five Hope Sixes, which really put us in a position to really transition some of our communities and make them more mixed income type communities. And so in doing that, we've been able to, in some cases, be able to make those families, those communities, if you will, higher opportunity areas by bringing in high wealth, high income individuals to those particular communities. But at the same time, schools hadn't always caught up with that. And so in some cases, in some of my communities, you could probably draw a Section 8 around low-performing schools and high poverty areas. No pun intended, but I think there's a little pun intended. And so what we're trying to do now is look at ways through our own mobility program, our housing opportunity program, is to really go out here and communicate with owners and see how we can actually get more of the market when it comes to the Housing Choice Voucher Program. We have things like, there was a question earlier about, we have income source discrimination. That's legal in Charlotte. We do not have inclusionary zoning in Charlotte. So we have some structural issues that we have to overcome in order to get our families into these areas. And so we've hired some individuals to kind of help them search, go out and actually communicate with these landlords and let them know that we have some fantastic participants that just need a little more opportunity. We've been able to also increase our payment standards, so now we can actually get into some of the areas that we couldn't get before, right? We couldn't get into some of the southern parts of our city because the prices were too high, and the fair market rents that HUD was giving us didn't allow our residents to be able to move there. Now we're able to go up to 150% of the area median income on these particular units, and so now we're able to get more of our families there. So Charlotte is different than Seattle in a lot of different ways, but we're happy because we're almost ready to get into the opportunity insights and start working with them on exactly how we can scale the program that we already have.
Great. I'm going to come back and ask you more about that, Fulton. So let's hear a little bit about Seattle King County.
All right. So Seattle and King County is different than Charlotte. And so I think it's good to sort of be hearing about this work in different communities throughout the country. I'm pleased to see that Nathan put up maps so you guys have a sense of the geography of King County and Seattle. King County is the jurisdiction that the King County Housing Authority serves, and then in the center of it, there's the Seattle Housing Authority, and the Seattle Housing Authority covers that jurisdiction. So we've made it very complicated for voucher holders at the outset. King County is a really huge geography. It's about the size of Delaware. 1.3 million people live in King County outside of Seattle, and I think about 750,000 people live in Seattle proper. It's also very, very fragmented in terms of municipalities. So if we're thinking about structural issues, if we're thinking about local policies and the impact of local politics, that is something that is very much alive and well in King County. There's 38 different municipalities. KCAJ also covers unincorporated King County. So we cover 19 different school districts. It's just very much of a patchwork. But on the plus side, it's one housing authority. And so I think because we have this sort of regional scope, when we have looked at our neighborhood, certainly with the opportunity atlas, but when we've looked at our community even before that, we've seen the variability and, you know, where we have such variability along economic lines, along poverty rate lines, along school quality, all these things, and that definitely shows up alive and true in the maps that Nathan was talking about too, and that has really been a motivator for us to think about the role that the Housing Authority should be playing in place and really thinking critically and more strategically around how we can work on deconcentration work. I think that from our family's perspective, it's important to point out, I don't think they even realize when they come in the geography that KCHA covers, and we can talk about that more later maybe in terms of how that plays in to the work that the navigators are doing with families around opportunity area education. But the other, I think, important backdrop that certainly our families are feeling and that is alive and well is that we've seen enormous economic growth in Seattle and King County that has been fueled by the tech industry. And that has been great for many. It has not benefited our families, for sure. That has primarily benefited people who are much higher income, I would say moderate to high income, but primarily high, right? And so we are seeing a tremendous bifurcation of wealth in our community. Our families have certainly not benefited from that, but they have felt the impacts because that economic growth has made huge impacts on our housing market. And so, you know, vacancy rates are incredibly tight.
I mean, less than 1% in most areas. So the competition for units is just staggering. I was looking at some data with my team last week, and I was like, this can't be right, that year upon year, this one community has had 0% vacancy, and it has. So there is a need for affordable housing, for sure. We've also seen that rents have continued to increase. For a one-bedroom unit, the median rent is now $2,000 in King County, and we are talking about needing units that are much larger than that for our families. And so families are being pushed into different communities, and they don't necessarily feel like they have a lot of choice in the matter or that they necessarily have the tools. And I think that's what we're hearing when families come in the door around how the broader sort of economic backdrop is impacting them.
Can I just briefly ask each of you, how much do you see the neighborhoods in which your families live, be they in place-based subsidized housing or voucher holders, suffering from high rates of violent crime? Back to the discussion from earlier with Pat and the long-term effects of that.
I would say it's pretty much the same throughout the city. I don't think it's disproportionately more. But I do think it is disproportionately more in the media. It's disproportionately more in the papers. You hear about it more. People see that more than you see it on the other side of town, which I do believe puts a situation where you see these communities as they're the problem, and the people in them are the problem as well.
Yeah, I think... I think one thing about Seattle and King County is that, fortunately, I don't think that we have experienced the same level of violent crime as other places in the country. I think that, safety and considerations of safety are factoring into our families' decisions may look quite different than the kind of conversations that, Stephanie and others have had with folks in Baltimore and other places in the country where there are much higher rates of violence and frankly, a greater proportion of really concentrated poverty than we see in Seattle and King County. That said, and Stephanie would be able to speak to this more, I do think safety is showing up in some conversations with families. I think that is sort of a constant. And I also think that, similar to what Felton was saying, I think where we see violent crime coming up, I think it often is connected to families in subsidized housing, which is incorrect, but that is the narrative that is shaped.
Yeah, so there's a reality and there's a perception I think each of you are alluding to there. So let's dig in a little bit on CMTO and assisted housing mobility for a few minutes. So maybe start with you, Marge, and ask you, given your storied history in researching discrimination, barriers to housing mobility, capital M, capital T, capital O. Like when you saw the findings from the research that Nathan presented, did you say, "Oh my God, that's blowing my mind," or did you say, "Of course, I've always known that," or something in between, or a little more nuanced?
So I thought it was really great, really heartening to see that well-designed, well-delivered, hands-on help tailored to the needs of families really makes a difference to what they can do. I was really interested and I think pleased that, in fact, you don't need to restrict the target location of the voucher. You give real help and extra help getting over those hurdles. But people can move wherever they want to move, where they think is best for their family. So I think that's really exciting to see those in such a rigorous research design. And I think it points to tools we can build in and should build in to the housing voucher program more fully. But people have also talked about source of income distribution. Source of income discrimination. And a couple of years ago, Urban did a structured testing study in 5 sites of the ability to use your voucher. And it shows how important it is to get more landlords accepting voucher holders, especially in high opportunity neighborhoods. As a research team, we sifted through more than 341,000 rental ads in those 5 study sites in order to get about 8,700 units that were available and met local voucher standards. So we were essentially on a large scale doing what families have to do to even identify a unit they could call and ask, do you accept vouchers? And when they made that call, the answer was no 78% of the time in Fort Worth, 76% of the time in LA, 67% of the time in Philadelphia, lower in Newark, 31%, and lower in DC, which does have source of income protection, 15%. So we didn't have enough sites to be able to say with rigor that source of income protections do it, but I think there's a good argument for pushing on that tool if you can enforce it, because you don't have to just put the protections in place, you have to enforce them. One other interesting thing I just want to put on the table is, we've already talked about the fact that the voucher program is too small to meet needs. It's not one in four, it's one in five eligible households gets assistance nationwide. Several of the presidential candidates have been talking about a renter tax credit in various flavors. Some of those flavors look an awful lot like a housing voucher delivered through your tax returns rather than by a housing authority. And I think there's a lot of really interesting questions there about whether it'll work better because there's less stigma, less concern about the housing authority bureaucracy, or whether it will work worse because there is no housing authority to support you and there is certainly no housing counseling to support you. So I think that's a really interesting area for us to be pushing on, whether we get a renter tax credit or not.
Right. Well, I'm in between two researchers, so I'm going to take it from the point of a CEO in dealing with this mobility question. It forced us to really deal with what you just talked about is all the bureaucracy that comes with managing this voucher program. The inspection process, timeliness of inspections, really being introspective about when you can actually pay. So we have to make this program more market-like. And that's what we've had to really have this, internal discussion with ourselves. How do you make the program more market-like? When you go look for an apartment, you go to an apartment, you do a criminal background check, credit check, if everything works out, then you ultimately go there, sign off on your deposit, pay your deposit, move in, right? With us, it takes a little longer than that, right? Sometimes 45 days, 60 days. And so we've had to talk with, and we created a landlord group that comes and talks, an advisory group that comes and talks about those issues. And that's what we can't do is be afraid of hearing the truth from them and being able to make those changes. So we've been able to reduce now those times for inspections down to 7 days. We're trying to get still working on our being able to pay at the same time a person moves in. But I think what it's doing now is allowing us more opportunities in the community to actually find housing for our participants, right? Because that's what this is at the end of the day, where they want to live, right? Definitely in the areas of opportunities, but where they want to live. And that's what this mobility program is kind of doing for us, being very introspective about it and how we can actually grow more of this market.
Yeah, Sarah, so I'm glad we're sort of talking about some of the details of implementation. And I wonder, like, as you look at just if you were just looking at Nathan's presentation about CMTO, you sort of know the main elements of the search assistance program, the landlord engagement. But sort of what about KCHA and, what you all went through in order to partner effectively around the demonstration might you not glean if you were just looking at reading the research paper? Like, what were the particularities, for your agency at that point in time for making this thing a reality and getting the results that you did?
Yeah, I think I think part of the motivation, but also one of the challenges we assumed at the outset was that we were launching this during such an expensive and tight time in the rental market. I think that sort of upped the ante for KCHA and SHA because I think we had this notion: if we can make this work here, then that will really be, you know, something else for us, right? And it also will be, I think, useful for understanding what are some of the elements of these services that might translate to housing authorities that are working in similarly tight rental markets. I think, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of the program design, and, you know, I'm so incredibly pleased and proud of it. And I think part of that is because we put a lot of time at the outset talking with families, talking with landlords, talking with our frontline staff who know the ins and outs of the barriers of why families are not leasing up quickly or leasing up at all, and spent months also working with our colleagues in Baltimore and Dallas and Chicago, learning about their programs, learning about which elements of those programs might translate well in Seattle and King County, and what places we may need to do some tailoring because of specific, you know, experiences in the market, and also with an eye towards how could we build out something that we thought would be as scalable and as efficient as possible. Because as this is something that we were launching in-house at the Housing Authority with our CBO partner, we wanted to only test things that we thought weren't just pie in the sky, but would be things that if they were effective, we could probably take to scale eventually. So, you know, part of those conversations led to a lot of the insights that Fulton's talking about. You know, we learned from landlords that it was our own bureaucracy that was often standing in the way of people getting their foot in the door. And so what were some efficiencies we could build in? And so Nathan talked about landlord outreach and engagement, but partly that was us doing a lot of deep thinking on our end around, like, how could we streamline pretty bureaucratic processes around the filing of new housing paperwork, around our inspection schedules, around how we actually get our rent checks processed, to have, you know, 1 to 3 day turnaround times, because that's what it was going to take to convince landlords in these hot markets that it was worth renting to a Section 8 voucher holder when there was another person right in line who would pay the same amount. It also meant working really closely with families to find out what had their prior experience been within the housing search process. And, you know, it was heartbreaking when we would hear from families that, you know, they didn't even know that they had poor credit until they had applied to a unit, and that's when they found out that they had this credit score that was keeping them out of housing. Well, that shouldn't be when people find out that information, and that's something that we can change, right? So incorporating into the Navigator services, running, you know, credit checks so that people are armed with that information. That's really powerful. And that's a not a simple operational change, but it's something that we can absolutely do. I think another surprising thing that came out is that, you know, we kind of assumed, you know, this is what the housing search process looks like. You know, you go to apartments.com, you go to Craigslist, you find units. And I think one thing that I remember talking with Stephanie about is that, and wasn't surprising because if we really thought about our conversations with families over the years, you know, it's so expensive in Seattle and King County. Most people have not done a lot of sort of traditional housing search because they didn't have the resources until they had a voucher to go do that. So they've been staying with family and friends. They've been going through sort of lots of sort of non-traditional housing search processes. And then they get this voucher and we're like, okay, the clock's ticking. Go find a place and go to apartments.com and you'll be fine. But that's an entirely new process. And so we need to set up how we build that information out with families and how we use that as a starting point. And I think the Navigators do a tremendous job with that. But I also think that there was great insights along the way about how we can just do a better job of explaining the voucher program, explaining, like, what are the limits, explaining where can, you know, what can your voucher pay for and where are the areas you can be moving. And those kind of operational changes are things that we can, you know, use to the benefit of anybody who's coming through the door. And
yeah, that's really helpful. Like, it seemed like a lot of things you're talking about are the positive externalities of having done a CMTO demonstration that spill over to families who aren't in CMTO proper. Correct?
And that was, like, I think that was one of a big motivation for the housing authorities participating, is, like, I think this was an opportunity to say, one, how can we start to think about mobility and how we support families' geographic choice more critically? And two, how can we use this as an opportunity to look under the hood and make our voucher program that much better functioning?
So notwithstanding that, I wanted to just stick sort of within the housing mobility space and sort of within the voucher space, I'm just sort of curious, in both of your instances, Fulton and Sarah, how much you feel like you are, you know, making a trade-off, right, between just like, right, like, I can serve X number of families with the gold-plated services versus the silver-plated services, right, and how you, as an agency and, a, you know, without unlimited resources, sort of weigh your activities in both of those classes?
That is the philosophical question, wasn't it? When we first
you're at the Brookings Institution,
I know,
so
I know, right? when we first started, you know, considering the program, that was the dilemma. We're in a city. Well, I have 13,000 people on the waiting list. We need 34,000 new affordable housing units in the city of Charlotte right now. And everybody was saying, you know, you just need to find housing now and go, right? Because I think everybody knows that HUD didn't give you additional money to do this, right? So you have new increased payment standards, but it takes maybe sometimes 1.5 of the amount of rent that you would pay in a standard unit than to move into a mobility, a high opportunity area. So our board struggled with that for a little bit of moving people fast anywhere they would like to go to really having a concentrated focus on trying to move people into high opportunity areas. And so we looked at a pilot of 100 families moving there. And so it is, I don't look at it as a trade-off. Let's say it's not a trade-off. It really is something of how we build and get to scale. I think that's what we're talking about. How do we get to scale? How do we, in this process, because we are finding some efficiencies in our program, and we're honing in on some of the issues that landlords have, how do we just make it better now for all the residents, all the participants that we have, so that there really is more choice? Right, because if we have good relationships with these new housing providers, just simply because this person moves out, they'll let another person move in, right? And that's how we're kind of taking it. Is this is our first foot in the door of selling the program in a place we've never been able to sell it before, opening up a market that we've never had before.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this trade-off, if we think of it that way, I mean, is something that we grapple with a ton, right? I mean, wait lists are long. Obviously, homelessness in Seattle and King County is a huge crisis. I think that, so that I think has taken us to task a lot over the last 5 years in thinking about how are we thinking about multi-tiered payment standards on our vouchers, and how are we thinking about our work in this space on mobility as well as our work on place-based. We had moved to multi-tiered payment standards before CMTO, and well before we had been in a two-tier system, and then had moved to 5 and now 6. There are some efficiencies in that, and you know, I think that that helps us to not lead the market in some of the lower cost areas, and then to not lag the market in some of the more expensive areas.
Can you just say, Sarah, so like a dollar difference across the tiers? We know the program is about $2,600 a client for the services. What is the incremental payment to get to the high opportunity neighborhoods for the voucher?
Okay. Do you have any? So I think that the difference between a 2-bedroom in 1 and 6, I want to say, is on the order of about $850. So it's quite a large span, right? But I think one of the reasons that we had gone to the multi-tiered standard is because it's not enough. It's not an equitable solution to be issuing a ton of vouchers that nobody can use. And it's not enough to issue a ton of vouchers that, as we've seen historically, can only be used in certain communities. And so we need to, the pendulum obviously can't swing so far that we're serving only a few number of folks. But I think that we've also taken a long game view on sort of the equity approach in this, that if we can really build in choice in an intentional way, which includes making sure that we're right-sizing the value of the voucher to these, that these local markets are demanding, and doing regular analysis, like we reanalyze our payment standards twice a year now to make sure that they're keeping pace with the market. That's how rapidly it's changing. That's what we need to do to make sure that people who have gotten this resource can use it and that their families can benefit from it. And at the same time, making sure that we're spreading this resource as far as we can. So, you know, we're keeping a really close eye, obviously, on these percentages of where folks are living by tier, and those are leading to real time conversations.
Marge is a former HUD official and somebody who spent, you know, is in touch with a lot of housing authorities around the country and thinks about a lot of different markets. So from your perspective, like, I don't know, how, when you think about this question of scale and the scalability of an intervention like CMTO, you know, and recognizing that we're probably next to some of the higher performing, higher capacity housing authorities in the country. So what comes to mind for you as ingredients for success in taking this up a level?
Well, so we're constrained as long as at the federal level, we're not willing to expand the housing voucher program. So, you know, sometimes we have these terrible fights between people of goodwill because we're battling over insufficient resources. Yes. So I really liked both your answers. I mean, these are creative, effective housing authorities thinking proactively about how to make low-cost adjustments that make the program work better for everybody, but not allowing this precious resource of a housing subsidy to be used, to limit families to neighborhoods where the evidence shows it may not do the adults any harm anymore. We've already done it. But it certainly is doing the children harm, and we ought to stop doing that with our scarce housing subsidy.
So let me just shift the conversation just a little bit, just a few degrees, and come back to the topic of the sort of the economic outcomes for adults, which was the topic of the paper that Jens presented earlier. On that note, let me start with you, Fulton, because I know this is a place where the Charlotte Housing Authority has had work requirements for its adult clients for some time now, and I wonder sort of what you've learned from that. And how you see some of the findings from, you know, Jens's paper, given what you've learned there, and given some of the other experiments that we've conducted on helping to move public housing clients into work, like Jobs Plus, strategies like family self-sufficiency that were alluded to in his paper too.
We really do believe you have to be more than bricks and sticks as a housing authority. We have a supportive services program with a mandatory work requirement. There's a difference. Mandatory work requirement is just saying, hey, basically get up, go to work, right? Not a lot of supports, just a requirement for people to go to work. Ours is completely different than that. We have a supportive services program with case managers that work with our families, identify what barriers are, what they might be, childcare, education, transportation. We pay for childcare. And so we're wrapping services around the requirement of a mandatory work requirement. We've seen some great success with that model. We have roughly a 48% graduation rate of positive moves. Positive moves means individuals that move out of subsidized housing into market rate housing. And so we just believe that this is the right model, and we'd like to see that combined also with now the mobility component of, okay, so we didn't really have a lot of impact before on adults. Why? Sometimes maybe there wasn't the right compassion and consequence to go along with that in our model of the supportive services to go along with the mandatory work requirement. And we've had some great success. We have Jobs Plus as well. We have a Jobs Plus program in a community that started out at 20% employment, now is at 75% employment. So when we talk to residents, some of it is they didn't know these supports were available. We're finding out that marketing our programs, and that's marketing, not just the first thing that they heard when they're signing off on a lease, but I mean, full-fledged marketing this program to people and making sure that they know it's available to them in newsletters and Facebook and other things is the way to get them connected. And so we really do feel that there are really many opportunities to move the needle on the adults as well as the children.
And do you feel from that experience, or do you have a sense as to how much the neighborhood in which they're living or the part of the city in which they're living plays into their success in moving to work or not? Like, do you really feel like this will overlap a lot with the mobility strategies, or are these two different things?
There's no question there's certain parts of the city that don't have as much, you know, transportation, not as close to transportation, further from job centers that do impact it. But I do believe that we do have a transportation system in Charlotte. So the real issue was is that in some cases the question for our families was never, have you thought about what you want to do? Right? You're 27 years old. Maybe you have not had a job. What would you like to do? What would you like to be? And then they tell you this, right? And then you put together with them a plan of action about how to do it and just watch them flourish, right? I mean, that's what it is. The intervention between case managers or that support team and the resident is where I think the real secret sauce is. That's where I think
the navigator model we were just
right.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that. Right. I mean, I think the secret sauce is asking families as experts, what do you think, right? And so I think Stephanie articulated it well in terms of how navigators and CMTO are talking about this. But it relates back to, I think, one of the interesting findings in, or at least what I pulled in the discussion of Yen's paper around families who had been part of MTO and had been employed, and sort of the disruptive effect of moves potentially on currently employed families. And so obviously I read that paper after we have been working with navigators, but I think one of the interesting things that I think the navigators, that is part of the navigator model, is really thinking about what are the unique circumstances and contours around each family's life, and how does employment, childcare, transportation, social networks play into that. And if families are currently working, thinking about where's your work located, where do you take your kids, where do you drop them off? Well, let's think about like how we would, I mean, the navigator is physically going out, driving different routes, going and looking at different maps of or driving on the bus routes with folks to figure out how might this work in your life given where you're working right now. And that means, to the conversation earlier about choice, that for some families, it's not going to make sense to move areas. And that's part of what I think makes the MTO successful, right? And so, I don't think of like the 54% who didn't move to high opportunity areas as not actually being successful in the intervention. I think maybe they ended up in where they are in their community in a way that feels more informed and more intentional, and that's really exciting. So I am hopeful that will have some impact on the economic outcomes that we see for families. But I think that this is, you know, the economics of the adults who are moving, it's a really heavy lift. We have FSS in our broader programs. We've moved to biennial inspections as a way to hopefully incentivize working. We have lots of partnerships with workforce development, and we do our own early learning programming as well as out of school time supports as a childcare resource for families. And that said, it's so expensive that the idea of moving into a living wage job and having consistent hours at a living wage salary is still really outside of the realm of possibility for a lot of our families.
Fulton, did you want to add to that?
No, I agree. We'll make this easy.
I like additions like that. All right, so Marge, you know, as again, someone sort of present at the creation of MTO, and I've maybe read a third of the bajillion MTO papers that folks have published over the years. So I have a slight sense of, you know, what the preponderance of the evidence was saying up to the point of Jens's new contribution. So I wonder how you reacted to the findings of that, thinking about experimental versus non-experimental. And then again, related to what I think, you know, these guys were just saying about the reality of work and the lives of folks who come into contact with public housing agencies and are coming from often very poor neighborhoods.
So I obviously, when the earliest MTO results found no employment and earnings effect, I was really disappointed by that. I'm disappointed by this latest evidence that no matter how you slice and dice those MTO findings for adults, including testing some arguments I have made about why we didn't see the results we expected, that there still isn't a strong argument that the move alone results in better employment and earnings outcomes for adults. But I think Stephanie's point about the complexity of these families' lives, your point about what a huge climb it is to get to a real living wage job, given the disadvantages you've been dealt from the outset, we may need to accept that for many families, a move alone isn't enough, and but that a move plus might be better than just the plus without the move. I think we still have a lot to learn on that. But I also want to come back to Stephanie's point about the health of the parents, health and mental health. So first of all, that is a really important outcome in and of itself for people to be healthier and not depressed and not anxious. But in addition, I believe the evidence says that one of the worst things for a child's well-being is to have a parent with depression. So addressing a parent's depression is a huge important benefit for kids. So we still have to figure out how to help adults whose opportunities have been so profoundly constrained, how to help them not just be great parents for their kids and give their kids a better shot, but make some headway up the economic ladder themselves.
I want to ask a penultimate question before my last question. So I guess I just wanted to get to this question of race a little more explicitly and use Charlotte and Seattle King County to illustrate, and thinking about the potential scale and the effects of mobility solutions. So just being real, Fulton, like how much is racism, you know, going to be a barrier for folks moving from that crescent to the southern and more prosperous parts of your city to their ability to make the move and to their success once they make that move?
Ask that question again.
How much do you feel like just plain old
messing with you?
Plain old racism.
Just messing with you.
I started shaking my boots when you said that.
No. Again, I started off the conversation saying we're in a southern city. Okay. I've talked to you about we don't have inclusionary zoning. We don't. We have pretty much income source discrimination. There's some things that are baked into the pie. A little bit that I think as a city we are really grappling with. We've had some very difficult conversations, I think, over the last 4 years about race, about equity. But one thing I'm happy about is I think we're facing it now. We had a pretty big blow up that we had to look ourselves in the face and say race is an issue. We didn't know. Some of us in our community didn't know that there really was an affordable housing crisis, or that individuals that really are looking for employment can't find that employment in the city. In a city that's growing so fast, 100 people moving there a day and buildings, 40,000 apartments going up every day, the question was, what is in it for me? So will it be an issue? Yes, it will be. But I think the leadership that we have in the city now, I would say both on the business side as well as the public side, are really facing that issue and trying to address equity when it comes to affordable housing. And we've raised over $175 million right now to put more additional units on the ground to give people more opportunity. That's that supply that we're talking about, right? Of where some of the families in which we serve on a day-to-day basis now will be able to live, work, and play. But racism has and is a barrier in this whole affordable housing issue.
Sarah?
Yeah, so we're not a southern city, and racism still plays, I think, a huge role in Seattle and King County. Shocking. But in true Northwest fashion, it's much more passive ways, perhaps. And so, you know, I think that while they were not statistically significant differences. You know, when Nathan showed those bar charts, we are seeing fewer black families move to high opportunity areas than white families. And I think racism plays into that. I think we have source of income discrimination now statewide in Washington. And I think that we are still seeing discrimination, just not in overt ways, and we need stronger enforcement. So I think that there is still lots of work to be done. I think two things on the more positive side. One is that I think the maps have been a really powerful tool in our work with families in the community to really think more empirically and, you know, move away from sort of assumptions that I think oftentimes were driven by assumptions on race and income of what are high opportunity neighborhoods. And so we had done prior work on mobility counseling long before CMTO with different maps and heard from a lot of families, like, you've picked a small number of very white communities and we're not interested in going there. And when we did the mapping with the Atlas, I think that it was helpful to see which communities came up, and it's a more diverse map than we've had in the past. And I think that that was really helpful. It gained a lot of trust, I think, frankly, in the families that we're working with, that we were taking new approaches to really understand what it was about these communities. And I think the other thing is that you can't talk about mobility, which relates to concentration of poverty and segregation, without talking about race and the role that the housing authorities play, have played in perpetuating that and what we need to do about it. But I think we were pretty slow to get there, frankly, at KCHA. And so I think this has prompted some really thoughtful conversations and strategies throughout the agency that have to do, that maybe were brought on by this mobility work, but I think have impacts like far above and beyond anything having to do with just CMTO.
Thank you, guys. Okay, so let me wrap up with a very sort of Brookings question. I think Jenny asked a version of this on her panel too, which is, where should the research and demonstration field be moving next? What should Nathan and his team at Opportunity Insights be doing next to really, you know, help us better understand not only the potential effects of assisted housing policy on economic mobility, but like how to do it well? Because, you know, I said in a think tank, but I've been told that implementation matters. So start with you, Marge.
So I want to come back to this secret sauce question that got raised a lot. And I agree that we need to understand better what aspects of a place make the biggest difference in terms of people's prospects. But I also want to suggest a tweak on this, that maybe the secret sauce is changing over time. I mean, the world is way different than it was in the decade when the kids we can see outcomes for were growing up. The internet wasn't the same kind of issue. The labor market was different. The housing market was different. I don't know what else is different because I grew up in the 1960s. So I think this is a real issue for me, that what makes an opportunity-supporting neighborhood may be changing in some ways, and we better get smarter about it. And then I just want to put out one other plea for researchers and research institutions, and that is to face up to race and racism in our work. And doing the kind of community-engaged listening that Stephanie does is part of that, because if you really listen to people and treat them as people who have wisdom to help inform the research and the policy development, I think you're going to learn a lot about race and racism. But there are ways to think about statistical methods that acknowledge racism instead of just treating race as this characteristic you put in as a dummy variable. And I think a lot of us have gotten the answers to our questions wrong. We probably asked some wrong questions, and we've definitely gotten our policy prescriptions wrong. I know I have. So this is something that I am really thinking about a lot. The Urban Institute is thinking about. Brookings is thinking about. We all really got to work on this.
Thanks, Marge. Fulton?
First, I just want to say thank you for giving practitioners like myself real information that we can go help our families with. And I just want to say thank you. Because for far too long, we've been thinking these things, but not being able to really move the needle from a policy standpoint, boards and et cetera, because they said, well, that really doesn't make a difference in somebody's life, maybe moving them to a high quality community, right? A high opportunity community. So thank you for giving us that information so that we can now move forward. There's empirical evidence that says we should do this, and that gives us permission to do it. I might be struggling a little bit about what else we can do, but I mean, technology, I mean, how does that play a part now in moving our families, let's say, to high opportunity areas that can't move to high opportunity areas, right? How can we engage this internet, this new world, to put our residents in a better position? Because we will constantly, I do believe, face issues where a hard unit, a physical unit, may not be available. So I would think that we need to be thinking broader than that to figure out, are there other ways for us to kind of, I think as we asked that question earlier today, what happened to those communities that people left from? Maybe technology is a way that we can increase the value of those areas.
That's great. Sarah?
So I think it's been suggested a lot already. So, I mean, I think that the place-based work needs further evidence for the reasons that Filton is describing. I think that it can really reinvigorate the policy and practice conversations. I think it will give us more precise tools. I think it will bring more folks to the table. So I think that's already been said, and I would wholeheartedly double down on all those suggestions. I think another place that would be helpful to get some additional inquiry is around, and it started up again, I think there's, you know, on looking at displacement and gentrification and really what's happening across these neighborhoods. I think in Seattle and King County, displacement is front and center, something we're thinking about in both families who are living in high opportunity as well as families that are living in lower opportunity communities. And I think we don't have a great evidence base to help us answer our questions and sort of shape our approaches to that in critical ways. And then I think the last suggestion or hope I would have would be to actually piggyback on what Stephanie was saying about really understanding families' experiences of neighborhoods and how families are defining their neighborhoods. So, you know, perhaps more in suburban communities like King County, but I think not dissimilar to lots of other places across the country, sort of how we have been describing neighborhoods is very much sort of an urban, kind of an urban way of describing it that I don't necessarily think shows up well for a lot of the families we work with. Like, it was hard to even think about a term to describe some of the neighborhoods on our maps because it's diffuse, right? And people have their own definition of what their neighborhood is, but it is based on sort of boundary lines that they have come up with. And so I would love to see some work around sort of revisiting how we're describing neighborhoods and neighborhoods across the country that doesn't necessarily just rely on census tracts or on sort of urban definitions of neighborhood. And so then the last thing I would just say is to, you know, second the thanks to have, you know, practitioners up here and to put a plug in for the conversations to continue to involve certainly families and the communities we're working with, as Marge said, but then also to continue to include housing authorities and other public institutions that are doing this work. So I think we haven't necessarily done a great job of bridging engagement with, but I think that we'll get much better findings that don't feel sort of black box if we continue these types of conversations.
That's great. Thanks to each of you. And yeah, and having done a little bit of field work in South King County over the years, right? Like the notion of like a neighborhood as represented by a census tract.
Yeah, I mean, come on. No. Right? Yeah, so, exactly.
Totally with you there. Look at that. I had only 10 seconds left for this portion of the panel. 9, 8, 7. So now we're going to go to question 6, 5, 4. Oh, wow. Okay. So there's somebody in the, where are the mics? Okay, great. So just like Jenny said, please identify yourself and your affiliation, if you would, and ask a question. My version of David Elwood's is your voice should turn up at the end of the sentence, unless you're Richard or from a Commonwealth country, in which case it may go down a little bit at the end of the question. So let's start in the back there on the aisle, the gentleman in the jacket there.
Hi, thanks. My name's Lawrence. I'm a reporter. And these conversations keep circling back to how research should inform policy. And I'm really interested in policies that, as Pat Sharkey put it, break down the barricades. So I'm wondering if you can give us some examples of places and policies that have been forceful and effective in breaking down some of those barriers. And to the extent that they are forceful, I would ask you to speculate on the long-term political ramifications, because we're seeing some real flashpoints, especially as regards school segregation right now.
Who would like to start on that? That sounds like, it sounded like a Marge question. I'm sorry, but yeah. And then we can get others warmed up.
Well, I wish there was a great example of a forceful policy to break down the barriers of segregation that didn't generate opposition that makes it difficult to sustain. I wish there was. But I think, you know, we all have to just keep piling our efforts on top of each other and plugging away at this challenge. But I have sort of three examples I'd put out there. One is from King County, which, if I understand the policy correctly, has quite bravely gone out and purchased existing rental properties that already exist in high opportunity areas. And essentially counted on the fact that the market is so hot that those rents are going to become extremely affordable over time, being places that not only opportunity voucher holders can live, but other moderate and lower income households can live. So, and that's done very quietly, because you're buying apartment buildings that exist already in a high opportunity location. So that's one. Everybody probably knows that Montgomery County has operated for a very long time inclusionary zoning program that goes beyond what most places do. It gives the housing authority the right to buy some of those units. So again, quietly, in a new development.
I really like that policy.
Yeah, it's a really cool policy. So you get moderate income families living in the below market units, but you also get some very low income families. And there's evidence there that, the effects for children are profound. And then Minneapolis just got rid of its single family zoning. And a lot of places are talking about that. And it's freaking out a lot of people in many places that are talking about it. But it's interesting to me that typically when we talk about upzoning and going for higher density, the conversation is about going to a lot higher density. And just saying we're going to just no more single family, we could, again, this is another, we could begin like moving in the right direction.
I'll say, too, for Charlotte, one of the things we're doing, too, is we have some very high-valued assets in Uptown Charlotte. And so what we're doing is really creating these mixed-income, mixed-use communities that are dense. Now, on our land, we can make inclusionary zoning a requirement, right? And so we're doing 80-20 deals now, where 80% of the property is market rate, 20% is affordable. And making them just dynamic places to live, kind of turning that area into what? A high opportunity area at the end of the day. So those are the type, I think all, if anybody can do those in their particular cities, I think that would be great.
All right, let's take another question. Where are the mics again? Let's get Solon. Hey, how you doing, Solon?
Solon Givergi, Senior Fellow at the Center for the Study of Social Policy. Marge, I just want to say real quickly, for the over a decade that I've known you, you always say structural racism. I wish you weren't always the only one who does it, but thank you for doing it. I was waiting for it. So
invented the term place conscious policy.
There you go.
I want everybody to know. So yeah, just keep.
So my
keep
question for all of you is about social ties and social networks to sustain the mix. And so once the move is done, there are things we knew about MTO in terms of relationships in and among young people and such. And Sarah, in particular, because of the immigrant refugee context of the Pacific Northwest, what are you finding either from the navigators around, are my people there? Will there be people to support me, the kind of cultural affinities in context, and how important that might be in the move?
Yeah, so I think it's something that we've thought about a lot. And in some ways, I kind of want to punt my answer on this until we have more data, right? So I think, you know,
we'll have the next panel talk about that one, Sarah. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Stick around. But I think we need to wait until we have more interviews that Stephanie and her team are working on with families around, you know, what was their, what's their social network look like and how much did it factor into their move decisions?
Anybody else on social networks? No? Okay. All right. A lot in the back row there, like very eager.
Thanks. I tried to ask a question on the last panel, so I'm still here and
glad
persistent.
To get you.
my name is Alex Dadek. I get to visit every once in a while with you all. My organization is called FAHI. We work in Appalachia, and so we're based in eastern Kentucky. And so I'm glad to be here with you all and appreciate all the work that the researchers on the first panel and these the fine practitioners here are doing on issues like structural racism and moving people to opportunity. I wanted to ask your, this is both for the panelists and for the Brookings staffers here, if you would care to answer, is the research focuses understandably on the larger cities because that's where the program, a pilot was. In a lot of parts of the country, we've got smaller cities and then towns where there are also, I'm holding a report that was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It's a draft, discussion draft. But it points out that 80% of the persistent poverty counties are non-metro. They're small cities and rurals. And that every majority Black and Native American county is also persistently poor, the majority of those in rural areas. And so I wonder, like in all of this discussion, I'm hoping that you all would elaborate a little bit on what you see as the opportunity for those places and how they can think about moving to opportunity given how a lot the attachment to place they have. And also if you want to relate it to the political barriers that were talked about because a lot of the legislators that make policy that may create housing vouchers, for example, and enough funds come from some of these more rural states and that has an impact on policy. So, yeah, I really appreciate that. And for the Brookings folks, I'd love to hear what you think because you're directing some of these kinds of panels and would also extend an invite to a tour for anybody who would like to come to Appalachia. We would love to have you and show you how it works there as well outside of some of these larger cities. So thank you.
Thank you, Alex. I can't speak exactly to the housing mobility strategies, and Marge is shaking me off.
I just want to say I feel really inadequate on this topic. And a couple of years ago, I tried to work with colleagues at Urban on this U.S. Partnership on Mobility from Poverty that the Gates Foundation funded. We tried to develop a communities of opportunity strategy that would be applicable in rural communities as well as urban, and we realized the policy challenges aren't the same, the solutions aren't the same. We didn't know enough to be useful on the rural issues, and frankly, we didn't find the kind of rich body of scholarship and experimentation to build on. So
I guess my follow-up then just quickly is like, why do you think that is? Like, why is it that Brookings and why isn't that research coming up? I wonder.
Yeah, Richard will weigh in, but yeah, you're catching two think tank people on the panel who have long been associated with centers within their institutions that have the title Metropolitan in their name. And so that's, you know, in a way, Appalachia is sort of othered and has not gotten the kind of, I think, policy attention. You know, and your organization was born out of the war on poverty and model cities and other kinds of very urban-focused programs in the late 1960s.
We've had a lot of conversations about it. We have scholars who would like to develop a rural program, and we haven't been able to get one off the ground. It may be that being called the Urban Institute makes it a little hard to get a rural program off the ground. But
Richard has one up his sleeve. So let's hear.
I just want to say that I did do a short paper where we just looked at the rural areas using the data from Opportunity Insights, which I'm happy to send to you, because most of the attention is with the cities, because that's where most of the people are, so it's reasonable in one way. And to try to look at, just in terms of correlations, what seemed to be the rural areas that showed high rates of upward mobility, and the slightly depressing finding was that they were all marked by pretty high levels of out-migration. Because, of course, what you're doing is you're seeing where the kids are from, but then you're measuring their adult earnings wherever they are, right? So you're not the measure is what are your earnings in your mid-30s compared to where you grew up, but in your mid-30s you might be somewhere else. And actually those areas did show quite levels of high levels of out-migration. So that was, in a way, quite a sobering finding, because what it suggested was, you know, it was to go up, you had to go out for many of these areas. So I think all that does is underline the need for these place-conscious policies, because back to where we were before, it's not as if everybody wants to leave, and they should have the choice to be able to stay in those places and still have a decent quality of life.
Yeah. And, you know, so my final offering, Alex, is that, you know, some of the work that my program is doing, it's not about housing mobility per se, but rather, you know, how do we create more centers of opportunity across the country that are effectively urban in nature, let's say mid-sized cities, but aren't too far from places like Eastern Kentucky, right? Aren't too far from other parts of Appalachia, aren't too far from, very small towns in states like Michigan or South Carolina, rather than assume that the policy solution lies in building much more housing in Washington and San Francisco and Seattle and Boston, which of course we should do, but we cannot expect, you know, every young person, nor should we want every young person from those kinds of communities to have to go that far away from their families and their communities to seek opportunity. Let's come up here. Let's get the gentleman sitting here, please. Yeah.
Hi, thanks. Henry Watson. I'm a PhD student at Georgetown. The thing I wanted to ask about is we've established that a lot of all these barriers are not just there by chance. They're intentionally erected to protect people from, like, the disadvantaged areas. So when it comes to mobility programs, I'm curious about what the reaction is from the middle and upper income families that reside in the high opportunity areas. What's their reaction to mobility programs? And in places where there's fractured local government, like you were saying, is there a political conflict between the local governments that represents the high opportunity areas and the local governments that represents the low opportunity areas? Because obviously one might have more interest in a mobility program than another, strictly speaking, from a rational protect my own perspective.
Well, you've heard of NIMBYism? Yes. Not in my backyard. Same thing plays out. The great thing, though, about the voucher program, it is so stealth in a lot of ways that individuals don't really know who that individual is, that they have a Section 8, that they're having any subsidy or anything else. And so that's what makes this, I think, a program that can be scaled, you know, if we had more vouchers that we could scale, because the issue is that you really can't tell. I do development as well. So when I'm doing a 150-unit apartment building and they know that since it's Fulton Meacham, he's going to have some affordable housing in it, I'm right in front of the zoning committee and city council, and I have little flags behind me saying, please vote no. And that influences the politics sometimes and the inability to build more affordable housing. But when already in the marketplace you have vacancies and now you can fill them this way, it's much more organic.
Yeah, I think we've been pretty stealth, as Fulton would say. But, you know, partly with CMTU, we wanted to make sure, and as you saw on that map, that we would see pretty diffuse distribution. So in terms of this impacting any particular receiving community a lot, there was no reason to be, like, sort of out in front. I think one thing, though, that has helped on the flip side of that in our work throughout the community, as Marge was saying, we've done a huge amount of work on development and acquisitions of units throughout the county. So 51% of the about 11,000 units that we own outright are in higher opportunity areas. And so we are already embedded in those communities. And one of the things that we're doing because of our MTW is working really closely with school districts throughout the county. And those are school districts in high and lower opportunity areas to make sure that we're figuring out how to bring those systems together. And I think that does help on some of the issues you're raising.
Okay, one last question. You want to go right here on the aisle?
Hi, my name is Rosa Lee from George Washington University. So for the Moving to Opportunity program is within the context of one region. And I'm just wondering whether it is possible even think about at the more federal level support and then moving to region, high opportunity region. This is might be related to the Alex at the back from rural to urban migration. But these days, if you wanted to move to across metropolitan area, that also there is a lot of structural barrier, especially housing rent prices. If you wanted to move from Charlotte to Seattle area, the rent difference is going to be thousands of dollars, not necessarily a couple of hundred dollars. So do you think finding a good opportunity region, opportunity moving to metro area is plausible or is it worthwhile? Like, I just wanted to hear about what's your insight for this.
In principle, the voucher program is federal, so you can move out of the metropolitan area you received the voucher in. It's not easy. And a few families in the Moving to Opportunity demonstration did move beyond the boundaries of the metropolitan area. But I actually think the question about rural communities was about how can those communities become places of opportunity without requiring everybody to leave them?
Do either of you want to weigh in on that? You're thinking about it, Sarah? Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the answer is it's possible whether it should be the emphasis of public policy or we should think that that's the solution that people are looking for, I guess is a separate question. So again, we'll come back to that on the next panel. But in the meanwhile, please thank me. Please join me in thanking our great panelists, Marge, Fulton, and Sarah. Back to Richard.
So I'm just going to close up. So
he won't take that long. Don't worry.
Because I do want to thank Alan and Johnny. I'm thrilled you mentioned Minneapolis. Jenny Schutz is leading a conference in Minneapolis with Abigail Wozniak on housing and mobility. I'm thrilled about that. Camille Bousset, my colleague here who runs the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative, is just embarking on a big project using qualitative research to look at social capital in Charlotte and how that relates to opportunity. I just want a couple of final thoughts. One is it's thrilling to me how the big quantitative data revolution is driving qualitative research, because you reach the very limits of what you can do with quantitative data. You know, if even with all the data that they've got, Opportunity Insights, and as Nathan said, running all of these regressions, and we still have no idea what's going on in these neighborhoods, then there's no choice but to go to those neighborhoods and ask people who live in those neighborhoods what's going on in those neighborhoods. And so I think it's a great irony that the big data quantitative revolution will actually, I think, lead to a flourishing in qualitative. I love the point about evaluation that Marge made and others made, which is, we should have evidence-based policymaking, but we shouldn't be so slavish about it that we shouldn't be open to the fact that sometimes you might get surprising positives, that sometimes you didn't expect A to happen, but it did. And I think, you know, at worst, that leads to what I think of as policy-based evidence-making, which is you retrospectively find evidence that something worked. But that the fear of that shouldn't stop us from being open to the fact that even though that's what the policy was supposed to do, it actually did other things too, which didn't mean that it failed. Turns out a little extra help with a lot of extra choice can work. And the last point is to pick up something Stephanie said. which is, you mentioned something, residential pessimism, which I think is really nice. There's sometimes a bit of policy pessimism too, I think, because it turns out that it's really, really hard to move things. It's really, really hard to do things that work and that can be shown to work. And it's really, really hard to replicate those things to other places and then show that they work again. So actually to find that there are things that can be done, that there are interventions that with good evaluation can move the needle in a way that we feel good about, is actually an incredibly positive note to come out of this research. It doesn't mean that we don't have to continue to be rigorous, but it does mean that sometimes the woe is me, nothing can ever possibly work mood, I think, was nicely punctured, along with the idea that this is about people's preferences by the work that we've heard today. And I'm thrilled, too, that we not only did the research, but the practitioners. And just as the same way that quantitative people are collaborating qualitative people, the people who are doing the implementation, the work on the ground, and the people researching it, all of those collaborations are, I think, where the future is. So with that, thank you to all of you for staying the course, and for those who are watching online, watch this space.